Why is Skoglund back?
I'm not a fan of what Zickman's trying to do.
Oh, they worked that one out with Minsky, right?
But I almost think we're going to have to have a...
The legislative commission on pensions and retirement will come to order. We, you know, Representative Murphy, this is what happens when we don't get our work done.
But if you turned it over to Representative Smith earlier,
well, I understand he just puts the gavel down. But this is why this is so long.
Mr. Chairman, I took you at your word when you said we extended 1 hour.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
I will try to talk less.
No,
Mr. Chair.
It's not the commission's fault. We just have a lot of bills. We obviously will not finish today, so we'll have to schedule another meeting. Hopefully, we have another week before session, don't we? So next week sometime. Do we have 2 weeks? Oh, good.
28 days in February.
It really would be good to have this off our platter as much as possible before the first. I get the impression that once we show up on the first, it's going to be pretty hectic.
No.
You don't think so?
Really?
Guest appearance by you.
Mr. Chair, this worked out better if you were having 2 meetings in 1 week to have them day on 2 days in a row rather than a day in between.
Well, we were
9 o'clock is better than 8 o'clock.
Well, we wanted to get done so you could watch the curling at the Olympics. I figure you live up in northern Minnesota. You all watch curling up there,
don't
you? You
know, I used to be a curling coach.
Did you?
Neither helps.
And the year I was a curling coach, although I had never known anything about curling, but I coached the Duluth Central girls curling team, and we won city champions.
Impressed.
Mr. Chair, the U.S. team, I think it's 0-3 right now. They could use Representative Murphy's help.
I was just told that they're scalping tickets for $400 to curling at the Olympics. $400 to see curling.
It's exciting.
It must be.
That sweeping stuff is really important.
You can go to the St. Paul Curling Club here, which I've done, and just walk in and don't need to know anybody, and you can watch all you want. Okay, Senate File 2047-2230. Senator Michelle.
Okay.
Mr. Martin.
Members, to just provide a brief background, and then we can have the conversation as it goes. The proposal here is to add to the retirement plans generally statute, Chapter 356, a procedure for the dissolution or for the division of pension benefits upon a marriage dissolution that reflects the Wisconsin retirement system rather than the current Minnesota procedure. The principal issue here is when the other spouse can start receiving a benefit based on the spouse who is a pension plan member. In Minnesota, the start of both benefits is when the retiree, when the actual plan member, chooses to retire and continues for the duration of that person's lifetime, unless there's a surviving spouse options selected. What the Wisconsin system does is implements a second payee and allows the second payee to begin the benefit when they choose to begin the benefit. So that's the primary issue here is how early or what sort of timing can be utilized by the ex-spouse who is not the pension plan member when they can draw a benefit. With that, I'll turn it over to Senator Michelle, and happy to answer questions. We'll go through the policy issues as we see fit.
Senator Michelle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Martin. I guess I'd ask for the commission's indulgence. This is a thick bill, and it goes farther afield than we have on some of our other bills over the last couple days. It gets into divorce law. Ms. Hansen, who's with me here, has been working at this for a couple years. She's done research. She's communicated with commission pension staff, and I think she's got an intriguing story to tell. So what I'd like to do is give her a few minutes to kind of lay out the background.
Very good. Welcome.
Thank you.
I'll be very brief, but because Mr. Martin has expressed the issue, but I would just like to see...
Why don't you introduce yourself for the...
Oh, my name is Jeannie Hansen, and I'm the divorced spouse of a state employee. I guess that's one way to characterize me.
And a literary agent, I say.
Yes, 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 and an English major type, so legislation is a little bit hard for me to understand. But I think that it would...
Because they're not in English.
Who do you think writes the legislation? English major types.
I hope so.
I hope not. Well, anyway, it seems as though we have an issue here that really is not fair. It doesn't come up very often. I mean, how many people retire from the state, get a divorce, are prosperous enough that they never put in for their pension, and then that leaves the ex-spouse in the lurch? So I don't think this would be happening every day, every week, every decade. It would probably, I think in some of the paperwork I saw, it hadn't happened at least since 87. So it's a really issue of fairness in my mind that, you know, an ex-spouse can wait to outlive me, and then I would never get what was the asset division in the divorce. The divorce judge divides up the assets, and, you know, we could have done it differently. One of the assets that I got was half of this pension, which I've now been prevented from getting for years and years. So that's basically my story. You know, I don't know. I'm sure it's not forgetfulness that he hasn't put in for his pension.
Well, I was going to ask. This is a positive act to prevent?
Well, I would think so. He's a lawyer. You know, I think he understands a little bit about how this goes or bothered to find out how it went. But neither the judge nor I would have anticipated this outcome, or the assets would have been divided differently.
And Mr. Martin, tell us, so what prevents the assets? What prevents? So no one can claim anything until someone takes their pension. I mean, that's bottom line.
Yes, Senator, that's the current law.
Lawyers.
When in 1987, the commission actually processed the bill that changed the way that Minnesota divides marital property upon a marriage dissolution. Before, there was no possibility for a second check to be cut by the pension fund. If a spouse was given a part of a pension plan member's benefit, they basically had to either get the money from the ex-spouse or garnish that person's bank account when the pension check was deposited. That was changed to allow basically the pension funds to cut two checks, and the two checks would only be cut when the member actually chose to retire. That was to make sure that the benefit started at the same time and ended at the same time. So that they did not incur any administrative hassles beyond the simple cutting of two checks, and did not incur any additional liability. When that pension law passed, it also provided, and I think part of the problem here is that the division of a pension was only supposed to occur as the last resort, when there were no other liquid assets that could be allocated. The value was to be taken into the total accommodation, but you only got to the pension and actually divided it if there were no other assets that were readily divisible. And it's not clear that happened in this case. The court or the lawyers involved either ignored or chose not to follow that part of the state law, which directs the court to divide only if there's no other way to actually get a balance. To again avoid the administrative complications for the various pension plans, and just to make it more workable for the parties involved. So the benefit can't begin until the member starts drawing. I think what may be the case here, based on some information from Ms. Hansen, that her ex-spouse is part of the MSRS unclassified plan, which is a defined contribution plan, so that the member is not losing value by waiting to draw their benefits. Because it's a defined contribution plan, there's a pot of gold, and that pot of gold does not go does not diminish with the passage of time. So I think that might be part of what's going on in this particular instance, too, is most members would not wait interminably to draw their pension because they would actually be losing actuarial value. The benefit, the biggest value is payable at the earliest age you can receive a full benefit. And so if a member would normally receive a full benefit at age 65, to wait to age 68 or to 70 is going to reduce their lifetime, and they will not receive a significantly larger benefit to compensate for that. So I think the reason why the economics work or produced this instance is, one, the court divided a pension rather than other assets, and then two, the member is in a plan where they don't lose value by waiting.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Betzold, I think, has a question.
Senator Betzold, are you going to tell us what the quadro system is?
Well, it is quite complicated, but frankly, in divorces, pensions are significant assets, and sometimes, I mean, when you get the house, sometimes you get a pension, and sometimes maybe there may not be a lot of other assets, but especially if you have somebody who's been, has been employed with one entity for a long time, I mean, the courts would recognize that both spouses should be entitled to that. I guess one question I've got here, and I can't find the answer. And when would your former husband have been eligible to start drawing upon that? So I don't know that we would want a policy where she could have drawn any earlier than he. But if he is eligible to do it and has been eligible for some time, there isn't any reason why she shouldn't be able to start taking advantage of it simply because he hasn't put. But I don't know is he eligible now, or has he been eligible for some period of time?
Yes, the divorce was final in 1999, and he retired before that. He retired before the divorce was final. Okay. So it's been a long
members,
time.
Ms. Hansen is using the word retired in a different sense than you folks probably use it. He terminated active state service.
Okay.
Retired in our sense means you actually start drawing a pension benefit.
Okay.
Yeah.
And he stopped working in 99. Yeah.
So, I mean, he would have vested at some point, but when would he have been eligible? When would he have been eligible to put in the paperwork and say, okay, now I want it?
Senator, age 55 is typical for MSRS general or okay. MSRS unclassified.
Okay.
Yeah, he's 63 now. Okay. So it's been a while. And okay. As Representative Betzold, is that how you pronounce it? Senator?
Yes.
It is, the divorce judge said, it was very common to quadro these pensions. People have a house and they've got a pension, and so you need to divide them, and it's typical. But if I lived in Wisconsin, I would have been able, as soon as the divorce was final, go over and say, well, I'll take my lump sum now. No paper, no big extra accounts, no big trouble for the state at all. And as far as I saw some staff remark that maybe you would have to set up and watch the life expectancy of the non-pension-holding spouse, I don't think you would need to do that at all. Would just need to get rid of them with the lump sum of what the judge had said they should get, and who cares if I die tomorrow or in 50 years? So I don't think it would be a very hard to administer this change. That I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
For those of us who don't know this word, quadro the system or quadro, I mean, we don't need too much of an explanation.
Qualified
domestic relations order.
Yeah.
Qualified domestic. Okay, so it's. Okay.
It's just the division, just yeah. Whatever.
Members, the quadro is a qualified domestic relations order. It came out of the 1974 federal ERISA law. It's used in the private sector, and we permit a federal quadro-like filing in this state. But it's a term of art in federal law that's come into general practice.
I noticed in one of the letters here that whoever administers the quadro system for Minnesota thinks that we need some. Ron Schweitzer.
Yes.
Administers the system for the state. Is he here? Or?
I think he's not in that job anymore, but in 99 I started calling him once a year to make sure that this hadn't been forgotten somehow as the years went by. And you know, we would have these very brief conversations where he would say no. And then after about 3 years, I said, you know, isn't there anything I can do? And he said, well, you should really think about this, because if he were to outlive you, you would get nothing. And that's when I thought, I better really do something about this for myself and any conceivable people to follow me in this position.
So he was one of your people?
Mr. Chair, he was. He's okay. A former employee.
Okay. So he didn't. There's not a system somewhere in the state. He worked for the fund. Okay.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, he worked for us.
And okay.
We could not, under the current law, we could not divide the pension. What is rather unique with this case, the person retired, and first of all, they're a member of our general employees retirement plan.
Let me ask a general question first. Is there some need? Is this more than just a single case that needs to be fixed, or is there a general policy here that you think we should be doing something about?
Mr. Chair, I think there are some minor parts that need to be fixed.
Okay.
But this proposal, I think, needs more study because it goes further than the case.
Okay, go ahead.
And I'll talk specifically about this case. In this case, the employee retired in January of 1999, is eligible for the Rule of 90, eligible for full retirement, and just is, the way I understand it, refusing to apply for his retirement. As soon as he applies, we could then honor the divorce decree. And the decree is very straightforward. It's not complicated at all. So in some cases where I see an issue where someone is eligible, they've terminated, and they just refuse to apply. And I've had people tell me that, say, I'm not going to apply because I don't want so-and-so to get anything out of my account. What I think I would recommend at this point, because of the changes in the bill go a little beyond some things that need to be done, is if we could draft an individual bill based on the fact that the employee is terminated, is qualified for full retirement, and then we could divide the pension from there, then we could have time to study the Wisconsin system. Because it does get complicated when you start calculating present value, you start separating accounts, you pay while they're active, you know, you're paying one while they're still contributing to a defined benefit plan. So it is a little more complicated. And then you add to that the multiple plans that we have. Each of the plans that we administer, for example, would have a different present value calculation because of, you know, the state patrol would have a different calculation than the general plan and the correctional plan and so forth. But certainly in this case, where the employee is just refusing to apply, I think there might be some sense in just drafting a bill to allow us to pay.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Smith.
I'd like to make a couple inquiries kind of on that as well. Ms. Hansen, you've given us a sheet outlining events since 1999. At the time of your marriage dissolution, well, let me ask you this. Was the marriage dissolution on the basis of a marital termination agreement or as
sure
a result of a trial of the issues?
I'm not sure I understand what you mean. It was
did you
divorce.
And your, I'm sorry, Ms. Hansen, were you represented by counsel at the time?
Yes.
Was your husband represented by counsel?
Yes.
Was there a marital termination agreement prepared
you
by
mean
your
from
attorneys?
The judge?
By your attorneys.
A settlement.
Was there a settlement agreement?
No. He wanted us to have a trial. So
did you have a trial?
We had to try. Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't understand the words. So the judge ruled this, that this is the way it should be done.
Senator Michelle, have you had any, have you sought out any input from the family law section of the State Bar Association on this issue?
I have not, Representative Smith.
Don't you think that would be wise?
I'd like to hear what they have to say, yes. And again, as I pointed out at the front, this goes pretty far afield from our typical pension discussion, but I do think Ms. Hansen pointed out some really dramatic issues of unfairness, and so we wanted to tee up this discussion. I know there's probably some others behind us here who'd like to kick in a comment or two, but I'd I think that's a good suggestion.
Well, I feel somewhat at a loss. Had the answer been yes to a marital termination agreement, it would have been a little more clear that the parties should have understood what was going on at the time in 1999. But even since that is not the case, if there were two attorneys involved representing both parties and there was a trial on the issues before a judge, surely this issue must have come up and been explained either to the parties or in court. I'm making that assumption. And I'm just curious why now, 7 years later, we're being asked to perform the duties of an appellate court and go in and modify the court's judgment. I don't know why we should do that.
Need some work.
I don't think it would be modifying the court's judgment. I doubt that the judge, the attorneys, or even my ex-husband and certainly I ever dreamt that someone would leave a pension sitting on the table. This is not something that is typical to do. And as I say, I don't even know if my ex-husband thought of it then, because usually it's just routine. You get your pension and you get your pension.
And Representative Smith, in response, the judge said this should be split. The pension should be split. That was the judge's order. That was his intent. I don't know how much discussion surrounded that, but that intent and that order cannot be effected until her former spouse exercises, literally writes out some paperwork, and he is, for reasons that I'm not familiar with, decided not to do that. So he's actually frustrating the intent of this original judge's order.
Are there courts, when they make the decision, that solve this issue in the settlement? Have you seen those circumstances?
Mr. Chair, I'm not aware of anyone where it requires them to actually apply for, you know, where it says specifically they have to apply for benefits at a certain time. Certainly a divorce decree probably could do that.
Well, I was going to ask, what if the lawyers and the judge had said, right, you know, we don't know when this person's ultimately going to retire, so we're saying there has to be a divvy of the assets at the moment they're eligible for a full retirement. Would you then just do a calculation of some sort and solve it? Or what would you do at that point? What if she had walked in with a court order that said, doesn't make any difference that he didn't apply? The court said, I get half of this right this moment. What would you do at that point?
Mr. Chair, I believe state law prohibits us from paying a benefit until they actually apply.
Okay, so a court can't do that.
Right.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I have a little trouble. In fact, I don't know how I can concur with the request here on the entire bill. I heard reference to Wisconsin law. Why aren't we the same way? Well, the staff pointed out that Wisconsin is a community property state, so there is significant difference. I would like to ask Mr. Martin if this commission moved Section 5 on page 11 of the bill only, would that be enough to solve her problem and not do any irrevocable harm at this table to the state's divorce law?
Members, Representative, no. Section 5 is making the entire bill retroactive so that it applies to Ms. Hansen. Because you need to specifically under the Constitution indicate when you want to do things retroactively.
Is there a section, Ms. Chairman, Mr. Martin, is there a section of the bill that we could move or language that we could move that would address her issue only, such as was asked?
Representative, I could contemplate how to draft it, but no, there's no provision in the current bill that could just be implemented for her benefit alone. It would take some additional drafting.
Is it doable?
Yes, I can conceive of how to do it for a single person. We would, in effect, set up a separate account for this particular person. You are affecting, there's always the possibility when you start to get into these, especially on a one-person bill, that you may get into litigation between the parties, mm-hmm. that you may be viewed as adversely affecting somebody's pension benefits. I don't know that he would win on the merits, but there could be some fussing about it. that would go on after, but I can contemplate how to draft it, yes. But I'm not sure I can do it on the fly right now.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess that I would propose that that would be a solution that we could consider. I'd hate to look for work for other folks, but I can imagine in the House they're going to be wanting to hear from the family law section of the bar as to how even that one narrow provision has effect on states law, and certainly how your entire proposal would. So I guess I would propose some narrow approach at trying to resolve this.
Could we, the other funds are lining up back there. Any thoughts?
Luther Thompson, representing TRA, and also from the First Class Cities. We certainly think that certainly the broad implications of this need further study. You know, the whole issue of separate accounts, the lump sum distribution, are certainly items that would cause us some difficulty. Now, we do have cases like this. She is not the only one. We have had people come in, and a spouse will say, you know, my husband is not, or wife is not retiring because he doesn't want me to get any of it. So I think she has a legitimate issue when you talk about the fairness. And if that single issue could be addressed by coming up with some kind of language as, you know, the earliest date of retirement, on reduced retirement, or age 55 or something of that nature. But to go beyond and start allowing lump sum distributions, and we're talking about public funds versus private funds, I think that's starting to be a dangerous precedent. You know, these funds are intended to provide an annuity, not necessarily a lump sum distribution for a property settlement. There are differences between Minnesota and Wisconsin. We do have the issue with attorneys. They do not understand, first of all, that quadros don't they do not apply to public plans unless they meet our statutory guidelines. So many times we get quadros that are not in compliance with our law, and we reject them.
So on that point, so that's the difference. A court could order 3M to do this.
Quadros they apply to private pension plans.
But they can't order a public plan against the law. Okay.
Quadros is kind of it's a term of art dealing with qualified domestic relations orders that apply to public pension plans. So, you know, I think there are a number of issues here, and if you look at the broad spectrum, this is not an isolated case. There certainly is an issue of fairness that maybe some language could be drafted on that. But before you get into these other issues, you're starting to treat our defined benefit plan more like a defined contribution plan when you start setting up separate accounts. I think there's some, you know, there may be some IRS considerations there. You have early distributions. If you have, you know, start allowing the lump sum, whether that's partial or whole, and whether or not that's appropriate for public plans. So I think, in general, this whole concept needs further study. But if you could draft an issue that dealt with the fairness thing, I think at least the First Class Cities and TRA would be willing to participate in that.
Any of the fund directors want to add anything different, or pretty much everybody concurs with those comments? Okay. What if, I mean, clearly we're going to have to do some drafting here. I may regret suggesting this, but I'm asking all the attorneys sitting here. What if I'm a little uncomfortable doing one case and basically solving the issue for one person, not knowing what we're all long-term going to do. So what if we split it by saying that we give some legal weight to this individual going back to Judge Aldrich or whoever's around and saying, hey, our settlement's being frustrated, and the legislature says that we can do this, we'll separate it. We'll make them calculate a number today. If you, in your judgment, judge, think that my husband's just being obnoxious, my ex is just being obnoxious, that way we haven't really set a precedent because we don't know the equities here. I'm not questioning what you're saying, but we don't know if there's not a different reason why your ex is doing one thing or the other. I mean, we weren't there. We don't know what the settlement is.
No,
we don't.
I don't really know.
Okay. So I'm just wondering if there wouldn't be a way to kind of throw it back to the court, but give her something to work with when she went back to the court.
The only thing about that is I have to hire lawyers. I have to go, you know, that's the only part about that.
Well,
do the lawyers understand what I'm saying?
Yeah,
here?
Well, Mr. Chair, the courts are not going to just decide a policy matter or something in the abstract. They have to have somebody has to bring an issue to them.
Right.
That's con- now, and it could very well happen that if we decided that Mrs. Hansen should get some of that pension now, notwithstanding the statute that requires her husband to apply for it, and if her husband were to feel that he's somehow adversely affected by the act that the legislature took, then they may come on in and, you know, on a number of grounds saying, well, this is special legislation, or that the legislature did it wrong and so forth, and then the judge would have to kind of sort it out depending on what we did. But it would probably apply to that case. And by the way, then the husband would also have to explain to the judge why he didn't apply.
Right.
You know, so I don't think he'd come in a very good side equitably on that one. But I don't think the judge is going to do anything unless we do something
right.
that causes him to do something, and somebody decides that to bring it back to the judge to do that. So, these things can come up. I've done my share of divorces over the years. I've had one legal separation, and when you do a legal separation, you do all the same work, and at the end of it, the parties are still married to each other. But the reason why it was done in this one particular case is because of a pension, because you know, the wife who I represented realized that as soon as I'm divorced, I don't get any more of the pension. So I want to stay married, but I just don't want to. I want to be legally separated from this guy. And sure enough, as soon as he retired, boom, she contacted me and said, "Okay, finalize the divorce now." So we did it.
You know, I want to reconsider that. Remember the other day, this woman she'd been with her significant other for 35 years with grandchildren. And we've got people doing stuff like this.
Yep.
Okay, Smith moves that staff work with Senator Michelle and try to come up with a individual person solution to this as a stopgap this year, and one that we can live with as a policy matter, because we don't want to set a precedent on something that we really haven't thought through yet. But I think in this instance, we'd like to provide some relief for this person who is thankfully brought this issue before the legislature. We're not as nimble as individual courts. We have to worry about potential for 4 million cases around these things. So I hope, well, Senator Michelle explained to you that we just aren't quite as nimble
mm-hmm.
on individual cases as others. So.
No, I can understand that. And it doesn't disadvantage the pension-holding spouse to have the other spouse, to have me get my share. There's no way it disadvantages. It doesn't.
I think we're not sure of that right now. I think we haven't thought through all that. There's a lot of implications potentially here, and we're just not sure. And it sounds like everybody agrees we're not talking about an early retirement situation. It would have to be a full benefit.
Yeah, we're talking about once the person retires.
So that's the Smith motion. Do you need it shorter than that, or staff's going to work with to try to come up with a one-person solution here, temporarily. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Hansen. Does your former husband know that you haven't received your portion?
Well, I'm sure that if he thought of it, he would know, because he knows it would be against the law for me to get it before he applies. And that's just the way, as these officials were saying.
But if he doesn't, if he hasn't thought about it and applied,
I'm sure
then you're sure he knows.
I think so.
Well, if it went to trial, it probably wasn't the most amicable separation. So, all right, on the Smith motion, are people comfortable? We probably can't do an overall thing. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted. Thanks, Senator Michelle. Thank you, Ms. Hansen. Senator Skoglund?
Okay.
We have a solution to this one. Mr. Burke? Whoops. Mr. Burke?
Members, this was a set of bills was on an earlier agenda, and the chair directed the parties to get together and see if they couldn't come up with a solution. The solution that the parties have agreed to is the drafting represented by Senate File 2248, Skoglund, House File 2462. And those, or that bill, would require the individual to pay the full actuarial value in order to receive the treatment specified. But in the full actuarial value statute that is referenced, there is the option of having the employer pick up a part of the cost. So that is the solution that the parties are requesting. There is a need for a verbal amendment on page 2, line 16, delete January and insert July.
Two line 16. Oops, that's not where I'm at. Where are we at here? Page 2, line 16.
Of the 2248 bill.
2248. Okay, page 2, line 16. Delete January, and insert July.
Yes.
Smith makes that motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion adopted. Good to go?
Yes.
Okay. Apparently there's been some work done with the fund, and this will accommodate the situation so the fund and the employee can figure out how to resolve this.
Mr. Chairman, we had good discussions.
Excellent. Okay. Smith moves 2248 as amended be incorporated. Discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion adopted. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Appreciate everybody working on that. Okay, Bitzel. Let's just see if there's anybody not on the commission here. Corrine, is Senator Corrine here? Come on up.
He's back here. He's hiding back here.
Mr. Burke. Senate file, this is number 12, Senate file 2360.
Members, the situation covered by this bill is a the Relief Association and city would like to pay a slightly larger survivor benefit to the surviving spouse of a Randall firefighter who was killed several months ago in a construction accident. The situation is this. The individual had only 1 year of service credit, although he actually provided about 18 months of actual service. And current law in statute does allow these Volunteer Fire Relief Associations to pay a minimum surviving spouse benefit based on 5 years of service. So that is existing law. However, there is the additional requirement that that's not effective until and unless the city and the Relief Association adopt that amendment and revise their bylaws accordingly. This city and Relief Association had not taken that action. This firefighter died, and in reviewing the situation, the parties realized that they wish they had adopted the local provision sooner, so that this individual would, in fact, be covered by that minimum benefit provided by statute. So my understanding is the City and Relief Association have now made that change in their bylaws, but the bylaw change cannot be retroactive, as would be needed in this case, without some legislative action. So that's what this bill would do, is it would allow retroactivity and would allow payment of that full minimum benefit. Now, given the benefit level of this pension plan, the surviving spouse has received $500. The plan pays a benefit of $500 per year of service. So the surviving spouse has received $500. The bill would allow an additional $2,000 to be paid to the individual, which would be equivalent to a five-year minimum benefit. So that's what the bill does. Mr. Chairman, I turn it back to you.
So have they, I miss this, have they changed to 1 year in their bylaws now?
Mr. Chairman, they have changed to allow a minimum five-year benefit in cases like this where death occurs before the individual has provided 5 years of service.
I see.
And that is existing law.
And is that that's not abnormal for local funds to do that?
It's not at all abnormal. It is permitted by the statute. It's simply that it's not effective for a given relief association until the relief association takes the necessary local actions.
Senator Langseth moves that Senate File 2360 be incorporated in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
It hasn't been voted on yet.
He's thanking me for making sure there was a motion.
Yeah.
Senator Bedsall.
I'm with the hundreds of plans that are out there. I mean, is there some way that other plans are alerted to this so they can also update their bylaws and make sure that they know what's going on? Or is
Senator, this provision, the minimum benefit, has been in the law since 1979.
Okay.
So they've had reason to be on notice before. It's not a recent change. So.
Just takes longer for some people to catch up.
What tends to happen, Senator, in volunteer fire plans is they borrow the bylaws of some other volunteer fire pension fund, and sometimes they're well-crafted and sometimes they're not well-crafted. And
yeah.
When circumstances like this happen, then they discover the frailties of whatever borrowed document they have.
You get what you pay for.
We have not had many retroactivity authorization bills in the past, so it hopefully it's a relatively small number that have not implemented this particular benefit.
Thank you.
Okay, other questions? Any concern from volunteer firefighter fund people? Okay. On the Langseth motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion adopted. Thank you, Senator Corey. Is this your first time before the commission?
This is my first time.
It's usually not this pleasant.
Well, I usually use that coring charm, and it always works every time.
You brought a good issue. That's what made the difference. So.
All my issues are good.
All your issues are good. Bedsall. Okay, we're not going to do number 10 today, I guess, the Bloomington School Custodians. Neither of the authors are available. Are there anybody here for the Bloomington School issue? Anybody here for the Bloomington School Custodians? Okay. All right. Well, then we can just go and try to knock some of these out of here. Number 3 on the agenda. Senator Bedsold.
I don't know if the people, if parties wanted a little more time. I think.
Okay.
As Representative Smith, did Representative Osmond want to be here?
He's not here today.
Okay.
I think, and the House, Representative Smith has told me the House may not be ready on this one yet.
Okay, yeah, if the House isn't ready, I'm happy to pass on it.
I think, Senator Bedsall, my sense is that we should do some behind-the-scenes work on this one, because I think there's going to be quite a bit of strong opposition to that.
I've talked to some of the folks as well, too, and I think that that's a little bit of time might be helpful.
Okay, so that may or may not be back on the agenda, depending on whether Senator Bedsall believes he's made some progress with folks. First, Ms. Kilberg, did you make somebody guilty, or why are you not on jury duty? Number 4.
It's not particularly her bill.
Oh, no, I guess this isn't your bill.
Hers is better on.
All right. Mr. Martin, this isn't your bill, but you're going to have to comment on it. Number 4, Mr. Martin.
Members, this is the second time that this bill has been on the commission agenda. It was on very early in the 2005 session. It reflects staff work done during the 2004-2005 interim where we were looking at some of the pension plan laws which should be comparable or uniform and where they are not. And in the case of the First Class City Teachers plans, the First Class City Teacher law is supposed to reflect the TRA law to the extent possible. And in the area of sabbatical leaves, the two sets of laws, Chapter 354 and Chapter 354A, have grown apart. So this attempts to implement the same changes that have been adapted for TRA plan for the first-class city teacher plans. When this was taken up by the commission during the 2005 session, I believe St. Paul teachers and Duluth teachers indicated that they were not interested in making these changes, and it was laid over to a future date.
Okay, and then why don't you talk about number five also. That's extended leave. Same deal?
Yes, Senator. The same circumstance. Again, the first-class city teacher law is supposed to reflect the current TRA law. They have grown apart, and this would make the two plans comparable. With the extended leave of absence, there are actually some provisions from the 1980s that are still in the first-class city teacher law that are no longer applicable, no longer in effect, and have been done away with in TRA law, but are not are removed in Chapter 354A. So there's some cleanup at a minimum that's needed to be done.
Okay, so we're looking at the two of these bills together. Ms. Kilberg, did you actually serve, or?
I did.
How did it go? What kind of trial was it?
It was a civil trial.
Interesting, or?
It was very interesting. I was on a jury, a seven-member jury with 420-somethings. So I was the grand dam of the jury.
Were you made the, what do you call it? The
foreperson?
The foreman?
Yes.
Because of your wisdom and?
Because of my old age.
Okay, what do you funds think of these two bills that Senator Bedsold and Representative Smith think are good ideas?
Mr. Chairman, members, Phil Kapler, St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund Association. I think we're sort of right back where we were last year. At this point, Mr. Martin characterized it as not interested. We're interested. Our concern with this, and I think it remains the same concern, is that this is a provision that operates a little differently, the sabbatical and extended leave programs between the basic and the coordinated plans. And it's sort of an employer staff management professional development provision and accommodation through the retirement program that we think the employer units and the employees should be brought in on the discussion before any substantive change is made. Currently, we allow, basically this describes sort of how the basic plan in St. Paul works, and but on the coordinated side, we do allow members and the employer to contribute in at half of the normal contribution rate. They're paid at half salary. At the end of that period, the member is eligible to buy up the other half when they come back to work if they wish to.
Let me just ask this, and before we get into the specifics, is there a reason why you wouldn't do it the same way locally as TRE does it statewide? Does somebody like it better the way it's done in your local fund versus the state fund? Because that's the essence of the issue here. Is there a reason to have a difference?
Well, I think so.
Okay.
It's a different school district, and
that may not be persuasive, but we know they're different school districts, but is there a reason to have a different?
They have a different contractual arrangement with their employees. The sabbatical leave and extended leave provisions and accommodations that are made in the contracts with the teachers
are different,
and presumably in negotiating those provisions, something else was traded off on the employer and employee side. So it is a little bit entangled, if you will, or related to other provisions on salary and benefits that they've been able to negotiate to this point. Now, I know the law could come in and supersede what's in the contract, but I don't know what kind of issues that raises from a Pelro standpoint. But it's a sort of issue that I think could be worked out with the districts and the employees if they were brought into the discussion, but we just haven't had the opportunity to do that at this point in giving them an opportunity to review the legislation.
Was there a moment in time where the local funds were in sync with TRA on these two provisions? Was there ever a time where you were the same?
Under our basic plan in St. Paul, for us, I can speak, we do, in effect, what is described on the sabbatical leave here. For basic plan members, the employer continues to deduct. They actually get paid half salary, but the employer deducts the full employee contribution and makes the full employer contribution. So there isn't this catch-up at the end and the option for the member to decide whether they want to buy up to a full year of service credit.
What if we only do coordinateds? Don't worry about the basics. Leave the basics where they are and just worry about coordinateds.
This would conform the coordinated people to the basics, and in St. Paul, at least, I can say that they're not. This would be a change in policy for them.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, Karen Kilburn, Minneapolis Teachers Retirement Fund. I don't think that we would have a problem changing the coordinated members to being the same. However, we do want to make sure that changes aren't made to the Articles of Incorporation because many of our leave provisions and so forth are different in the basic plan. And although we only have maybe 200 active basic members left, it just seems a little unfair to be changing the requirements for them at this point.
Mr. Chair, Jay Stoffel, Director of the Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund. In my experience with directing the Duluth Fund, I've never seen a sabbatical leave used. It requires the district to pay a salary while the teacher's on a leave. So with the situation in the Duluth Public School District, they haven't found a use for it or a need for it. So, my comments on the legislation are, with that kind of a background. I guess my question would be, currently, it seems the teacher has the ability, if they were on a sabbatical leave, to pay. They have the choice to pay for the sabbatical leave whether they want to or not. And then if the teacher pays, then the employer is billed. And under the legislation, it seems that we're mandating that the employee has to pay for the full year based on a full year of salary and mandate that the employer has to pay their share as well. That seems to be the change that, if I'm understanding the bill correctly. So we're taking the discretion away from the teacher to pay or not to pay for the leave time, which I guess if that's the policy, the direction that the legislature wants to take, that's one thing. But, and again, it's with the background that we don't use, I've never seen the sabbatical leave used, so it's not going to impact us to any great degree.
Okay.
If I might add, Mr. Chairman, members, one difference between the first class city plants and the statewide teachers fund is, they're dealing with multiple employer units, and administering something like the purchase of the up to a full year of service for somebody who's contributed at half over the course of the sabbatical leave might be, from an administrative standpoint, and TRA can speak better on this, more of an administrative headache for them to manage those buy-ups, if you will, after the completion of the leave. Whereas we're dealing with one employer unit, and usually that means one contact over at the district payroll office to deal with. From a logistical standpoint, it's not the same issue for us, I don't think, as it would be for TRA. So conceptually, there might be a reason for having a difference in policy as it is in law.
Senator Bedsold and Smith. I think this comes from staff. This was staff generated, but it comes from the general notion that the commission is trying to fulfill its kind of own policy of uniformity in funds where uniformity is called for. Mm-hmm. And at least on the coordinated portion, I think there's a general policy that we should be coordinated. We should be uniform on the coordinated portion of the teachers' funds. Did I articulate that correctly? I think that's been a general policy of the commission.
Senator, if I could add, when the coordinated programs were created in Minneapolis Teachers and St. Paul Teachers, the first version of them, first version of the first class city teacher law was a set of cross references to TRA law. The commission staff observed that left problems in not knowing whether definitions also applied, just how necessary adaptations need to be made. And we suggested to the commission, and the commission ultimately recommended creating what's now Chapter 354A. The understanding was that the first class city teacher coordinated law was to reflect TRA law. Had we left the set of cross references, the change that's proposed in the sabbatical leave bill, for instance, would have automatically occurred when TRA changed its law. all we're doing is doing the what we view as the clerical update that would have occurred had we not convinced you that having a separate written document for the first class A teachers made sense. But if we had stayed with the old cross-reference portion,
Mr. Chairman,
adds some perspective.
If I may, the only problem that I have with that concept is the fact that if TRA, from an administrative standpoint, decides to change something because it's for the benefit of their situation with far more members and many more employers, then that means that whether it is good for us administratively or from a standpoint of our relationship with our school district, our plan would also be changed. So I think that we do have to take a look at the fact that we are different.
The way this is drafted, though, if we adopted these, we'd have the challenge again where we'd have to come back and change the local laws. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the protection on that point. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of inclined to do these bills for the coordinated members, although sounds like Minneapolis can live with that. Can Duluth live with that?
We can live with it because mainly we really don't use the statute.
Okay. And if St. Paul is just adamant that you want more time to work on one of them, you know, maybe we could leave St. Paul out now or something. But,
Mr. Chair, I think that came up briefly in the discussion with the three directors, but I think that we're trying, the idea is to make everybody the same. But in both of these bills, there are tools for the school district to negotiate with their units, with their public employee units for benefits in the negotiations that are different. And I think Mr. Stoffel said that, you know, we haven't had a sabbatical, and we haven't since Duluth hasn't had a sabbatical since 1964 that I know of. But
they're moving into the 20th century.
In every single negotiations, sabbaticals were discussed and promoted. And every year I was on the negotiating team, it was one of the last things to be thrown out in the negotiation process. So it hasn't been a forgotten thing, and it could come about at some time. And I think, you know, school districts need some incentives to try to reduce their staffs or to provide incentives for their staffs or to do things. And by trying to establish a uniform pension thing, I think these go over the line of pension things because these items in these two bills are more than pension issues, but they are incentives and tools that the school district has for their own negotiation purposes. And I think we're stepping over into the public employee labor relations. We're taking too much away from that bill.
School district people, are you here? Labor union people? So does anybody who represents the school districts have a comment? I saw this. Aren't they here anymore?
I saw Solberg.
You have TRA, they don't care. Senator Schwab, do you have anything? Okay. You want to say something, ma'am?
I'm Mary Millar from MinSCU, from Minnesota State Colleges and Universities Office of the Chancellor, and our interest would be as an employer, fairly minor, but we do still have, from pre-merger, we do still have people who are covered by Duluth teachers, Minneapolis, St. Paul. They're not a large group of people, but those individuals can be sitting working right next to someone who's covered by TRA and then have different provisions that cover
some
them.
People are
So, I mean, that's just from our standpoint, we've always had that issue that they're a little different. But it's not that many folks.
Sarah Betzels and Representative Smith, why don't you limit this just to Minneapolis right now? Move slowly.
Mr. Chair, I was trying, as I was listening to the testimony, I was thinking, who brought this to me in the first place? You know,
it came out of staff.
As you mentioned that up, I mean, there's usually a reason why I introduce bills. So.
Just can't remember.
No, staff's doing their work, and they, you know, it's one of the things. Mr. Grathwell, do you want to say anything? You don't have to. Do you use this in negotiations or?
Mr. Chair, members, Jim Grathwell, Minneapolis Public Schools. It's always a pleasure to appear before you, but I actually don't have anything. I haven't
Thank
had a
you.
Chance to look at this, Karen. Okay.
Thanks. That's fine.
Thanks.
Does anybody need TRA to say anything? Or okay. What if we just do Minneapolis, Mary?
I'm going to vote no.
Let's do Minneapolis. I mean, we're trying to consolidate the fund, for gosh sakes.
I agree.
Don, can we do just Minneapolis?
Yeah. Well,
Betzel moves. Betzel and Smith move to have these two bills apply just to Minneapolis and that they be incorporated in the omnibus bill. Mary, we're trying to consolidate the Minneapolis fund.
Ruth doesn't care.
On the motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion's adopted. Ms. Kilberg, are you nervous? You got separated from the pack?
Mr. Chairman.
Just for coordinated members.
Mr. Chairman and members, my only comment is we have much bigger fish to fry than worrying about some of these minor changes. Yeah. And if we have to focus now on making these changes and can't keep our focus on what is really important, I just find that a little.
Well, is this a lot of work for you to do?
Well, it's going to change the way we do our leave. Provisions.
Tell you what, after we find out what happens with all pension stuff this year,
yep.
If this is too much of an administrative burden, maybe it won't come.
I just find it kind of ironic that I'm the one who was trying to be agreeable here and I'm the only one who's going to have to pay the price. But that's fine.
Huh? Mary, do you want to raise that we don't actually have three votes on your side? Do you want to raise that?
Yes.
Okay. There's not enough votes to incorporate this right now. There's only two votes on the House.
You misheard. Okay.
I misheard. So, okay. Well, I think Minneapolis should try to coordinate with TRA pretty quickly on these issues.
Yeah.
Well, Betzel and Smith, you'd think you could get a simple bill passed.
Mr. Chairman, you'd think.
Guys. Always amazed.
The two of you guys. Betzel, do you want to try again with the next one? Mr. Martin.
Members, Senate File 435 is part of the same package of bills that the Commission staff generated during the 2004 interim. This probably is going to take more conversation than you folks want to pursue it at this time. This makes more consistent the omitted salary deduction provisions of all the major pension funds. There is considerable differentials in the way that all the plans handle the circumstance of when someone does not have deductions made in a timely fashion. And this is something back in 1987, the commission added a provision to Chapter 356, which required that administrative bills be, in effect, pre-introduced, be run past the commission for a comment in the fall. Part of that same piece of legislation does require various pension funds to be pursuing uniformity in various areas, and this is in that style, in that rubric, this is attempting to also make more uniform. So I'm not sure you want to spend the time trying to sort out with the various funds who would be advantaged, who would be disadvantaged, but we do raise the issue that this is one of the areas where there is considerable differential. Some individuals have their member contributions paid at a relatively early stage in the process when they were failed to be, when they were omitted from our deduction. Other members do not get the benefit of ever having the employer pay for an omitted contribution. That differential in treatment is problematic, I think, long term, and does merit some looking at some point. But this, just because of the time and if we couldn't get a relatively simple proposition of making the leave provisions between plans that historically were identical again, this is probably going to be more problematic for the pension commission.
Now, I don't want the staff to get discouraged.
Senator, we will continue to pursue these
okay.
As issues. If your disposition of them is up to you, and I just okay. want to warn you that time may not be on your side.
Okay. Could I get some of the fund directors up here real quick? Could we get some of the fund directors up here? Is this an area where you all could do some work to kind of bring some uniformity?
Mr. Chair and members, Mary Vanek, PERA. I'd like to briefly explain why we have 3 years.
No, we don't want to go to that level of detail.
Do you want to do that?
I just want to know whether this is an area the fund directors think some work could be done to bring some uniformity or...
I think we had discussion yesterday. We believe that we'd like to have some further work to
right.
see if we can come to some common ground. And okay. personally, I was looking at lifting the 3 years but my staff has indicated that we have hundreds and hundreds of omitted deductions every year because of our complicated rules. So I think we need to sit with the other funds and talk about where can we have commonalities and where do we really need to differ.
TRA, MSRS. Mr. Kepler.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, the concern we have is the limit on the sort of three-year statute of limitations. And this arose as part and parcel of our IRS conformity bill 2 years ago that Representative Smith heroically championed for us. One of the considerations that was raised by our attorney was that language not be applied to St. Paul because their interpretation of the IRS regs is that a qualified plan can't put a statute of limitations on the recovery of omitted deductions, that those become the employer unit's responsibility from the IRS's perspective, and there is no limit. If they go back 20, 30 years, you got to go back and get them. Otherwise, there's a risk of impairment of a person's.
Okay, but that's no different for the other funds either, right?
I don't want to speak for them. I'm just saying in our conferences with our attorney, that's the interpretation they rendered to us.
Is there some work that could be done here, Mr.
Luther? Luther Thompson, TRA. I think the big issue of this, if you have that three-year limitation, then the big question is, what are you going to do about service credit? TRA would be opposed to that because right now we go back and get any omitted deductions. The bigger issue is the schools sometimes don't report correctly on these leaves, so time elapses, and then all of a sudden the member comes and says, well, I was supposed to get the credit. The school was supposed to report it. The employer has to bear has to be responsible for making sure they comply with reporting requirements so we don't have omitted deductions. Otherwise, you're going to have a big issue with service credit issues. And, you know, if you had omitted deductions.
You're going a little further
okay.
than.
The simple
question is this. Is there a reason why funds are different in this area?
It's because of legislation.
Okay. That's why we're here. We pass legislation.
And
the staff has suggested that there may not be good reasons for differences, and so what we're suggesting is, could this be something you could all work on so that next year when the commission meets, there'll be a bill sitting here that everybody goes, that's a great idea, let's just do that.
Well, I think Ms. Vanek has mentioned there is a big difference certainly between PERA and PRA on this because they do have, and their omitted deductions are a different problem than our
okay.
omitted deductions.
Okay. If there is room for differences, maybe that's okay. But I'm getting some nods. Mr. Bergstrom, is this an area that some work could be done? Obviously, this is not as high a priority as paying benefits to people who deserve benefits. But, you know, the legislature, you know, maybe this would avoid pieces of legislation someday if we had more uniformity.
Absolutely.
Mr. Chair, you would, but let me point out the Bloomington case, because we do have a three-year statute of limitation. There's a potential of a $205,000 bill to the school district because now individuals are coming forward and saying, I should have had that credit. So I do think we need to sit down
okay.
with your staff and talk further
okay.
about this.
Okay, so let's do that. And whoever the chair is next year, is going to really want this thing resolved. And you know what? I'm still going to be on this commission next year. I can't get off. Well, that's assuming I get reelected, I suppose. So. All right. Thank you, directors. Now we got a good one. Senate File, Ed, let's do Senate File 70.
Members, Senate File 70, House File 40 is the cap on the SBI post-retirement investment fund. The bill as proposed would impose a 5% cap on benefit increases in any given year. This is the second time it's been on the agenda. There is a need for a technical amendment if the commission chooses to take any action on this. The technical amendment is the 045 amendment, and the other three amendments that I list there on the cover sheet are substantive of some form, amendments that would allow the commission to set some cap other than 5%. And the 047 and 048 amendments are amendments that would add a little more clarity to what is to be done with any reserves that are that can't be used to support annuities because we have a cap that is, in fact, effective at any point in time. If there are more assets in the fund, but we can't provide a full increase because of that 5% cap, we wind up with excess assets. And one thing that's not really covered in the drafting is just what is to be done with those assets. So the two suggestions that I make are you could allocate them all to the next year or allocate them to each of the next 4 years, which those are the 047 and 048 amendments. You may recall that the SBI Post Fund operates by setting up these accounts for five given years. And each year, as the assets are determined and the calculations are done, we have either excess assets that are put into each of these accounts or perhaps a negative amount if the investment performance has been very poor in a given year. And if we impose a cap, that can result in some assets which we then have to decide what to do with. And one of these amendments is to allocate the excess equally to each of those five accounts, or the other one is to allocate it simply to the one for the coming year. By allocating it to four accounts, that's more consistent with the possible policy objective of smoothing increases over time. If you add all this money to the next year's account, it would increase the likelihood of an increase being payable in that year and possibly a fairly large increase being payable. So it has implications for the distribution of increases over time.
Okay. We can go more on that after we decide on the overall policy. We have had testimony from the fund directors, but let's just recap that real quick. Statewide fund directors. And again, I think everybody knows what your position is, but let's just recap it.
Mr. Chair and members, Mary Vanek, PERA. Our position is to move forward with the bill as proposed, which would continue to smooth the excess and positive and negative market value over 5 years, would continue to provide a cost of living adjustment up to 2.5%, and when investment gains are available, to distribute those at no more than a total post-retirement adjustment of 5% going forward. There was testimony at the last meeting on this issue about possibly raising the cost of living adjustment to as high as 3% given recent increases in inflation. We did cost that out. It would add an additional 1.2% of pay to PERA, which means we'd have to increase contributions again by an additional 1.2%, and would require an immediate $230 million transfer to the post fund to cover the existing retirees. So it is a significant cost to raise that CPI guarantee at this point in time.
So you would take the technical amendment, and then 47 or 48 would be your preference on the reserves?
I don't have the technical amendment.
Oh, okay. Well, how about the, do you know about the excess reserves possibilities?
That's an issue that I'd like to have Mr. Bicker address because okay. That is a technical part of how they calculate.
Okay, well, we'll come back, Mr. Bicker. Mr. Thompson.
Yes, Luther Thompson, TRA. I concur with Perez's comments. I mean, the big issue is if you're going to have an additional guarantee above the 2.5%, it's going to be very expensive. I mean, your assumed rate of return is going to have to go above 8.5% on the post fund, and it's a big cost. So something needs to be done, but this seems to be the best for the time being.
Mr. Chair, the MSRS board supports this. They've been working on it for about 2.5-3 years, and it is supported by the MRSEA, the Minnesota Retired State Employees Association. So where we don't have the support of all of our retirees, the largest group we have representing about 8,000 of our current retirees is actually on record supporting this proposal this way.
And so it would affect these three funds and by implication MRF? Not MRF? Do you think it would affect MRF?
It would.
Staff thinks it would affect MRF.
Mr. Chair, Judith Johnson. If that's the case, we may need to exclude them. I do personally, although the board has not taken a position on this bill, I believe it's Mr. Martin's idea that it should be 6% for MRF because we didn't participate in the uniformity bill. That creates a bit of a twist for us, unfortunately, because then we lose the grandfathering, I think, under the IRS rules. We have looked at this a bit. Where the board currently is it'll be 10 to 15 years before we would actually have this implemented in any case because we're at the same funding level right now as the SBI. At that point, we believe we would probably merge with PERA. In other words, we have 350 members left. And when the members retire, the active members, our thought is that the board would merge with PERA and it would automatically apply. But because our members didn't get the one-time benefit bump in the uniformity bill, capping them at 5% creates an unfairness, even though that unfairness probably wouldn't occur until 10 or 15 years. We were excluded from the uniformity bill by a one-line change in the statute, so hopefully we could be in this regard too, especially if going to the 6% then creates IRS problems.
Mr. Chair, members, I just also wanted to advise the Commission that there was discussion about a delayed effective date at the last hearing. And we are proposing a delayed effective date of July 1, 2010, which would give us time to get our IRS letter ruling and deal with any other outstanding issues on implementing this. We don't expect it will even apply before then, but it does at least put the later date in the law.
And, Mr. Chair, actually, that would be wonderful news because perhaps we could pay and then join in that and then use the 6% number to run by them. And if they approve that also, then I don't think we would be opposed.
Okay. So we would have a July 1st date, the 045 amendment, and something that excludes MRF, I think would make sense. Why create opposition to this? So, but there's going to be some more testimony. So.
And the effective date, too, I think.
Yeah, July 1st effective date. July 1st, 2010.
Okay.
The 045 amendment and a removing MRF from it.
And we would commit, Mr. Chair, to joining PERA on this IRS ruling because the board didn't have a conceptual problem with the 6%. Okay. We just were fearful of the IRS.
Yeah. Thiessen moves those amendments.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Burke.
I'm confused about what you mean by removing MRF. I mean, if you remove MRF, you don't have a post fund. You don't have a post fund adjustment. Right now, your operational statute is this SBI post fund provision. So I'm assuming what you
excluded
mean
from this change would not incorporate the cap.
Right. In other words, that would be the only difference.
So there would be a need to draft language which would have the existing SBI post fund law apply to MRF and this cap apply to the SBI funds.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Thiessen moves that plus the effective date plus the 045. Discussion. All in favor say aye. All opposed. Motion adopted. Okay. Anybody else want to testify? I believe there may be others. Oh, Mr. On the general concept before we get to the how to do the excess funds, you think there's a Mr. Levang? Is Mr. Levang here? Welcome.
The technical amendment.
Senator Pogermiller, members of the commission. My name is Kurt Levang. I testified at the last meeting on the same issue that we're dealing with now. And I represent the Elementary Principals Association Retirement Committee. Our association and membership are really concerned about the 5% cap and its effect upon losing the grandfather status of any raises over the 5%. And we're not really sure about what is involved in this, if the cap could be set at 6% or whatever and then still retain the grandfather status without losing it, or if you make a change in the your bill or your law that you are required to go to 5% because of the IRS. I don't have any understanding of, you know, what the situation is on that. And also, I don't think the membership you have of the associations that testified here really understand what's happening. The associations have supported this change at 5% and the limit at 5%, but I don't think the membership really understands what this all entails. And I retired in 1996, and I got several very good raises. It's not going to affect me as much as it's going to affect those people that retired in the last 5 years and the next 15 years, because they're going to be pretty well stuck with cost of living raises. I don't see it as being a rush to do this, because as it's been stated, it's going to be 15 years before anybody is going to even get close to be getting a 5% raise the way the fund needs to be replenished with the money. So my question is, and my concern is for the committee, that If you set the, let's say, the limit at 6%, would that not paint you into a corner, so that in case something comes up and we're discussing something 5-6 years from now where it's necessary to use a raise higher than 5% to fix some of the problems that we have with people that are retiring at the second lowest check out of the 35 states that have a combination of Social Security and their pension plan, would you be painted into a corner because you wanted to make some adjustments? So that's my concern, is establishing this 5% at this particular point in time. Does that lock you in? Or if you make a change in it all, are you locked into picking the 5%, or could you take 5.5 or 6 to continue to retain the grandfather status that you enjoy right now? I don't know if anybody can answer that question for me. Would appreciate it, but our association, our membership is not in favor of the 5% as it's sitting there, because we figure we'd lose our grandfather status on this.
Well, if we pass the 5% into law and someone wants more than 5% at some point in the future, we'd have to change the law. The grandfather part I'm not totally tracking on.
Well, I'm talking about federal law. It says that you can't give a raise above 5%. Am I incorrect on that?
Mr. Bergstrom?
Mr. Chair, the federal law puts some requirements on cost of living adjustments. For example, they cap them in some cases at 5%. The reason that we put the delayed effective date on is to give us time to go to the IRS to make sure that what we are proposing does meet the requirements. And that is why we put the delayed effective date. So if the IRS says no, then we would come back and eliminate that law. And what they're referring to in the grandfather clause, they essentially said for public employee groups that you can keep what you have as long as you don't change it. And that is the reason we want to go to the IRS, to make sure they're comfortable with what we're doing. And that's why we are putting forward the delayed effective date.
And you can't get an IRS ruling unless there's something in law you can point to say,
right,
we need a ruling.
Mr. Chair, that's exactly right. We have to have it in law, or they have made it clear that they won't rule unless there is something legitimate that they need to rule on.
And Mr. Levang, some from overall policy perspective, this is viewed as a important reform to help in the overall pension system, to make sure we have balance on costs and benefits. So I think it's also in that larger context. It's not just by itself. Some members of the legislature are interested in this because it balances with some other things that might go on regarding other pension policies. And I think the state auditor is interested in doing this. I know the governor's office is interested in doing this. So it's in a larger context. It's not an isolated thing. I don't know if that helps, but...
It's just it's a very serious concern as far as membership is concerned. And
thank you.
I said, by the 5%, I don't know, 5.5 or whatever.
Thank you very much for your bird dogging of this. Appreciate it. Anybody else want to testify? Welcome. Steve, I think we've...
Senator Pogue-Miller, members of the... Pension Commission. I'm Charles Burnside. I'm a 2000 retiree under TRA. I think there are a couple things about...
Could you say your name? I didn't hear
it. Charles Burnside.
Thank you.
A 2000 retiree from TRA.
Great. Thank you.
There are a couple things that I think should be pointed out. The group that I am a part of, namely all of the people who have retired after the year 2000, are now currently receiving benefits that are less than cost of living adjustment, that entire group, as a result of the 2.6 increase in cost of living during the last period of time. Going forward, it is apparent that over the next few years we'll probably have cost of living adjustments in excess of that 2.5, or the need for those, and we are guaranteed that we will not receive those. So you have a pretty significant size group of people who are now going to be receiving less than cost of living adjustments. Mr. Levang has testified that he's quite pleased, as that whole group should be, who retired anytime significantly before 1999. They did receive very good benefits, and based on the current system. What you're proposing with a 5% cap is that there's a squeeze that can take place now. Those of us who have lived through the 80s realize that there were times when cost of living was very, very significant. If the most you can ever receive is the number that ties into the 5% cap, high cost of living are going to squeeze us, even if the results of investments are stellar. If the cost of living is somewhere above 2.5%, and the returns on investments are not stellar, we're going to be squeezed there. So this whole group from 2000 on are going to be negatively affected, and I think that that's the plan that you're talking about putting in place. The only suggestion that I could make is that perhaps there ought to be some look at that particular group who is being negatively affected and determine whether there is a way to make sure that their adjustments help bring them into line with that whole group that retired prior to the year 2000.
Questions?
Yes.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much for taking the time. Anybody else? Mr. Stanton. Mr. Stanton, if I was rude to you yesterday, I apologize. So I didn't mean to be.
Mr. Chair, members, Russ Stanton, I represent the
interfaculty organization, the union for the faculty at the state universities, and we would support the 5% cap as proposed. You know, back in the late 90s, we had people getting 9, 10, 11% cost of living adjustments when the CPI was, you know, 2, 3%. And people who continued to work actually ended up with less as a pension than the people who had retired earlier because of those cost of living adjustments. And we think a system that is more equitable and smooths out the cost of living adjustments so that some don't get a huge windfall and some get almost nothing. And if you put the cap on it, the quicker the fund would be replenished and people have a possibility of getting more than the minimum 2.5%. So we think it's good policy. The more you can make the cost of living adjustments follow the cost of living rather than market returns, I think the better the policy it is for everybody.
Great.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. Anybody else? Then let's talk. Mr. Bicker, we need to decide between 047 and 048 or some other version. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Howard Bicker. I'm the director of the State Investment Board. First of all, for the record, the State Board of Investment has voted to support the 5% proposal. As far as the technical amendments proposed by staff, it'd really be my recommendation you do neither. Current law will allow the exact formula to continue to work that is working right now, which would carry forward to the ensuing year any balance, whether it's negative and or positive, to be used in that year. So we really do not, from a technical standpoint, need either one of those amendments.
Mr. Burke? Do we need some clarification on the language?
Mr. Chairman, no, you really do not.
Mr. Chairman, it's always struck me that that's a part of the law that's a bit fuzzy. It just seems to be uncovered, but if
where is the reference there? Let's look at that language.
Mr. Chairman and members, if I could help, I mean, we've looked at that. The auditors have looked at it. We've been doing this calculation since.
Now we're going to do something radical. Yeah. Legislators are going to look at the language. Where's the language?
Mr. Chairman, on page 4.
Last page of the memo.
About line 20 of the memo. And basically, I'm not finding any language that in the bill as it stands that says what is to be done with excess reserves that can't be used because of that cap.
Now, Mr. Bicker, do you have some
Mr.
language
Bicker
there that
can
where do you
Mr.
think?
Chairman and members, it's not reserves, it'll be excess assets. The reserves are the counter side to this equation, so it'd be assets, not reserves.
Okay, and where's the language that you think's?
I don't have the entire statute in front of me.
Mr. Martin?
Members, I think what Mr. Bicker is probably referring to is on page 2 of the bill, so it would be the third page from the back. There's up on line 4 and thereafter, there's a provision that requires the State Board to look at the market value of the plan versus the required reserves. And if you're paying out less of an increase, the reserves are not as great as they otherwise would be. The market value reflects whatever the asset value would be, and that gain will pop into the formula there.
It's there.
Okay. Are members comfortable with that? Okay. So Representative Smith moves that Senate File 70, House File 40 as amended. We've got the 045 on it, July 1st, 2010 amendment, and we did one other thing. Oh, a MRF exclusion language just on this cap would all be incorporated. And members, Representative Smith and I were just talking. We'll have to make a decision at some point whether to put this in the first pension bill that's all non-tech, that's basically no controversy at all, or whether this would be better in a second bill that has more meaty policy. policy issues. And I think we just need to decide that after we figure out what other issues we have. So, but this will be incorporated somewhere. Discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion adopted. Okay. Could we look, House, at number 17?
17.
Oh.
There better be number 17.
It's Senate File 427.
Members, those items are after the salmon-colored piece of paper.
About 427.
And these are the items that did pass in Omnibus 1 last year, the Senate, and were items that had passed the commission and were not viewed as overly controversial. And so I think we just need some sense of which of those items, if there's something there that the House needs some work on, we should do that. Otherwise, I think we ought to just get these incorporated again. These are items that were removed by the House when they were trying to get a bill passed. It's unclear that any of these items were of concern. I don't know the answer. Representative Thiessen?
No.
Representative Smith?
Mr. Chairman, I think you may be essentially correct with one caveat.
Okay.
If we're looking... Well, first of all, my recollection is, and the record I think would show that the House was working off of Senate File 44, not the 427. And secondly, number one, and number two, that 427 Senate file is still where it is still
lying
where right. It was put, and that's the House Government Ops. Of these numbered items, I think without going into any detail for this particular record, I think some were deleted because of the time and also the appearance of propriety, perhaps, on some of these issues. With the one caveat, and that is, I think the number five item, I think Representative Osmond and Hackbarth had some input into the deletion.
Okay.
And since Representative Osmond is not here, I guess I would request the House not being ready on that particular item.
On five, okay.
Yeah.
How about the Mr. Martin?
Members, having staffed the omnibus pension bill on the House floor when it occurred during the special session, I have some recollection of the controversy or conversations. Items 1, 2, and 3 were all blocked together in the Omnibus Pension Bill 1. It's the legislator's plan, the elected state officer's cleanup, and the judge's plan cleanup. The problem that the House had was an uneasiness in making any changes in the legislator's plan going into a general election year where they may be misconstrued as providing any sort of a benefit increase for sitting legislators.
Okay.
And because they took the whole article, they also took the elected state officers and the judge's plan provisions out. So I think separating those and doing them separately or not blocking them all together in one article, as we unfortunately did, cost the judges and the other state officers.
Okay, let's just review quickly, and we can technically do this. We can have that separate, so if that uneasiness comes forward again,
mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
But let's review what is in the in number one, so that the commission has clear in its mind whether we can ease people's fears on that. What is in there with regards to revision or update of the legislator's retirement plan?
Members, in the first item, which is, and you have a copy of Senate File 427 with you, other would be attached. It's essentially the first 29 sections of Article 1. This is literally just a cleanup, doing away with obsolete provisions, reordering the definitions into alphabetical order so it's easier to find the definitions. There are, in fact, no substantive changes that would increase or diminish benefits for any sitting legislator or any retired legislator.
It's actually called clarification recodification. Okay, but the idea here would be we will have the legislative one. Do you really want it in a separate article? Well,
Mr. Chairman,
Why don't we just go with it the way it is?
Senator, by virtue of the fact that it amends Chapter 3A and we do everything by numerical order based on the statutes, it's going to be at the start of whatever article you put it in. We have the misfortune of being at the start of the first article. It was very apparent.
Okay, well, we'll try to figure something out there. We can maybe fix that. But, again, anything in the, at least these provisions related to the legislative plan are purely recod and clarification, as the commission understands it. And we'll try to pass that along to other members. Think that'll be enough in the House or not?
It's only for pre-97 people?
Members, the current legislative plan only applies to something like 77 sitting legislators. There are legislators who had taken office before 1987. All post-87 legislators are in the unclassified plan.
97.
It was some.
There's only 77 people left prior to 97. Wow. Mm-hmm.
Well, a number of shorter service legislators after 97 chose the unclassified plan rather than the legislator's plan. So that 77 is a subset of all the pre-97 legislators.
Oh, I see.
Because I think there are members of the current pension commission, for instance, who elected to take the unclassified plan rather than the legislator's plan.
Really? Okay.
Right now. So some sitting legislators who have service before 97 did make the shift. All post-97 legislators have no choice.
Well, I'm one of those 77, I would guess, right?
So Senator, I only know who did or didn't based on their telling me, not because I have any.
Well, I think I'm going to check, but I think I stayed with the records. Plan. So nothing in that article increases or decreases any benefit that I might have.
Senator, to the best of my knowledge, and this has been reviewed by the MSRS staff also, that this is a neutral on benefits recodification.
Mr. Bergstrom,
still not gonna get
we're just trying to get as much clarification. Maybe a letter from the fund to legislators,
Chair,
would help.
I don't think it makes any difference. It's not going to get in there, and we shouldn't talk about it anymore.
A recodification
until next year.
Yes,
Mr. Chair. Legislative pension benefits. Those three words. It's not going to get in.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, we did review the language, and it is technical and did not change any legislators' benefits. Okay. Now, yesterday when we talked about the judges' survivor benefits,
That's a different deal. That would not be in right here.
I just wanted to clarify.
We'll have that separate somewhere.
And if you would, Mr. Chair, if you would like a letter from
why don't you get us
I'd
one.
Be happy to do that.
We'll see what happens. And we'll draft, we'll consult. Representative Smith and I will visit, and we'll figure out a way to present it in the bill that if Representative Murphy is correct, it won't take two and three out also. And maybe we'll be doing this in a more timely fashion this year, so we'll do it earlier, so perhaps it won't be that rush at the end. You got to be more optimistic. I think the House is going to show great courage and do a recodification of the legislators' plan this year. I really do. Don't you think so, Senator?
I bet they will in 2007.
But
Mr. Chair, Senator Bedzold.
Last year was 2005, which wasn't an election year, so I don't know what the difference is. Just don't use the term benefits anywhere, and I think it's okay.
Mr. Chair, some of us remember 1978 very well.
I do, too.
But that was actually a benefit increase. This isn't. There's
but the words are the same, Mr. Chair.
Well, we're going to find out if words matter. Now, Representative Smith, I'm going to put a little politics in here right now. We're going to find out if words matter depending on the court decision on taxes or fees. We're going to find out if words matter.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I have seen I've seen a pension bill rise from the dead in the last 5 minutes on the House floor, so I'm convinced anything on God's green earth can happen. Yes.
Okay, so 1, 2, and 3, the commission, the motion is to reaffirm that we think those should pass. Discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion adopted. 4.
Item 4, members, you actually did. This is the supplemental plan for union pension plans. You did this yesterday as part of a freestanding bill. So, and you added, in addition to the laborers union, which was in the, the 2005 omnibus bill, you also did the machinist union. So 4 you've already taken care of.
So that's already in then. Okay.
That's already been incorporated.
And 5, we will not, that needs some revisiting in front of the commission, or, okay?
Yeah. Yes.
And, okay, so that one we need to keep alive, number 5. And then number 6.
Mr. Chair, I think we have some amendments.
Okay.
Members, there is one amendment that I'm aware of, which has to do with the, well, it makes two changes. Item 1, the delete section 1 part of the A1 amendment does away with a provision that had to do with the salary of the executive director that was dealt with during 2005, and the problem that it was trying to correct has been done away with. So there's no need to make that change. The second part of it, which is the page 195 language, makes this retroactive back to June 30, 2005, which is requested by the city of Minneapolis and presumably by the pension fund.
Ms. Johnson, Minneapolis. And this isn't quite getting at the issue of whether the House is willing to do this yet or not, but you want to get the bill in the shape that it needs to be in.
Mr. Chair, Judith Johnson again. As of last year, the school district account with MRF, each employer at MRF has their own separate account. It is somewhat unusual in terms of numbers, went negative. What that means is that I had to send them a bill as of September 1, 2005, that under the accounting rules has to be paid by August 31st, 2006. The amount of that bill was $16,900,000. Even for a school district the size of Minneapolis, it's a fairly large number. But for the operation of the requirement to bill the employers, they would have paid off that $16 million over the next 15 years at a much lower cost. And so I did suggest to the schools that, with the legislator's permission, they might want to have that bill effective June 30th, 2005, so that they could pay off the $16.9 million over the next 15 years instead of all at once. If they do have to pay it all at once, they have bonding authority to do so. We know that there are some members of the House and actually in the administration who don't particularly care for pension bonds. And while the city has had to issue pension bonds in the past, I was hopeful that they might not have to issue bonds for MRF. And so that's why we recommended that effective date. Essentially, that.
So this effective date will decrease the possibility that they'd issue pension bonds.
It would actually eliminate it for
eliminate.
This year completely.
Okay.
And because they say they can afford the payments
okay.
over the 15 years, it should eliminate it permanently.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members, Jim Grathwell, Minneapolis Public Schools. Yes.
You're for the amendment.
We support the amendment, especially the retroactive component.
Does the district think this eliminate the possibility that they have to that they will want to do bonds?
Yes.
Okay.
For this bonds for this particular for MRF.
Right. Anybody else want to testify? Okay, on the Thiessen motion, just to get it in shape. I think this helps in the House, doesn't it?
Yeah.
All in favor, say aye.
Oops.
I'm sorry, Mr. Bricker.
Mr. Chairman and members, this has been a relatively recent development. The proposed legislation says the board may certify assets for investments by the State Board of Investment.
What page is that on?
Page 189.
Okay. What line?
Line.
Oh, okay, I got it. Line 31. Go ahead.
This would allow MRF to invest in what we call our combined investment funds, which are the funds for active and retired employees, and in the supplemental investment funds. We have a group of mutual fund type things. We received actually a request from another entity that wanted to participate in some of these pools, and we did some legal work very recently on this. Unfortunately, we cannot let outside investors into our alternative investment pool. That's because we must certify to the organizations that we invest with that nobody can withdraw money from these pools. In other words, we got to have a guarantee if we commit to a venture capital fund that we will have money there for the five-year commitment period. If somebody has the ability to move in and out of those pools, we can no longer make those certifications, and therefore we can no longer invest in those. So unless somebody certifies money to the State Board of Investment on a permanent basis where they cannot withdraw that money, we can no longer make those certifications. So unfortunately, we must have an exemption from somebody be able to participate in the alternative investment portion of our pools that do not, that have the ability to also withdraw that money at some future date.
Mr. Chair, I suspect this could work out fine since that's the one area that the board was not going to place any money if we did place money, because alternative investments are against our investment policy. So perhaps we could carve out that piece or put language in that said subject to other restrictions at the state board. The only reason that this language was in here really to start with is as we move towards a merger date at some point with PARA, we want to be able to systematically move the money at no cost in advance of the merger. So it's 10 to 15 years off. So one thing you could do is completely remove it. Frankly, another, you could simply exclude the alternative investment category or to provide that subject to further restrictions.
Well, are you talking about 11A14 or 11A17?
14.
14?
17 is a supplemental investment funds, and if they're authorized, that's fine. We have no problem with that. And it's only our alternative investments, which are very basically
okay, so
private equity, real estate, venture capital.
So if we just put some language that references to 11A14 that subject to restrictions of the state board, that gets the job done?
That would be fine, I believe, Mr. Chairman. Again, I would have done this, but we just
That's
just
fine.
Did the work.
That's why we're here. Okay. Thiessen moves that language along those lines. Okay. Staff's work, they've got it. Discussion, all in favor say aye.
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 All opposed, motion adopted. Okay, House, what's your thinking on?
Oh. We adopt the other amendment as well?
Yes.
Is that the whole thing? Okay.
Yeah, we've got it now in the shape you want it.
Okay. So we adopted
it. I think we adopted the other amendment, didn't we?
No.
Oh, we didn't? Okay, then the A1 amendment, we might not have, did we?
No.
Thiessen moves the A1. Discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted. Okay. What's the House's thinking on the MRF provisions here now? Is that something you think the... Mary, I don't think that's what happened.
Didn't even take 5 minutes.
Mr. Chairman, are you still looking for some guidance from the House
yes,
on this
issue? Yes, we are.
I don't know that I can give it to you, but I think we probably would concur to put it in, and we can discuss it in the House.
Do you think it might have to be something that's in the second bill rather than that first non-controversial one, or you're not sure?
I'm not sure.
Okay, let's move to incorporate it, and then we'll, based on your further discussions, we'll make a determination whether it's in the first bill or the second bill.
All right.
Smith is moving that. Discussion for incorporation, undetermined first or second bill. Discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All
aye.
Opposed, motion adopted. Okay, then we're, let's see, Senator Bedsold and Murphy, are you ready on number 11? Or do you need to read some more and think some more about that?
I think I can start the discussion, Mr. Chair.
Number 11.
And this is on the St. Louis Park police officer issue. Mr. Chair, as I recall last year, the Pensions Commission did take a position on this. There were discussions in both the House and the Senate on this. And as Senator Larson previously mentioned, I was quite surprised to find it was included quite late, I believe on the night of June 29th during the special session, the Agriculture, Environment, and Community Development Bill. The next morning, of course, the Senate had to take the bill up first, and I actually was presiding when the bill was presented, so I didn't even have a chance to go through it and spot this provision. I think it was unconstitutional to put it in there. This was a broad bill, but as broad as it was, I don't think that it had any business having a pension provision in there. Be that as it may, whether you supported the idea or opposed the idea of in Senator Day or Sergeant Day's situation, I think that the language that was adopted was overly broad. I mean, it talks about, for purposes of this section, the line of duty includes active military service, which would apply, I think, to virtually anybody, you know, in this plan who is now deployed, who had served in the Guard or the Reserve and served in this plan, and then now was deployed and was doing work that has no relation to being a police or firefighter, and yet somehow is now on active duty. And it raises other issues, too, because there are plenty of other government employees who are serving in the Guard and Reserve who are also deployed, and yet if they are injured or killed in the line of duty, active military service, they're not going to be affected by this. It's only people in one particular plan or one particular area. So I think that this was just horribly bad policy and not well thought out, and it just shows what happens when people who are not familiar with these issues try to deal with them, and particularly when they stick it in some bill. And had we been in regular session, this would have been caught because the bill would have moved through the House Ways and Means Committee, the Senate Finance Committee, and we would have spotted it. But this bill was on a fast track to keep the state parks open. Be that as it may, I believe yes, we could repeal, we could move to repeal it, but I think that still brings the issue back up, and the same arguments are going to be made in the floor of the House and the Senate to do that. I certainly wouldn't mind doing that in and of itself. I like the idea of what this commission proposed to do, and that's have St. Louis Park pay their cost of this. They were the ones who were in here arguing strongly that this ought to be done, and yet when the issue came up that they ought to be contributing towards it, then they backed off and they didn't think it was such a good idea. I still think that they ought to be picking up part of the cost since they were the ones that were pushing so hard to have this done.
But, so you like number three?
I like number three.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, frankly, I think any of the numbers, one, two, or three, have merit and should be discussed, and probably should be selected to act on. I'm not personally satisfied with the way I saw this issue dealt with tail end of the last session. Frankly, Mr. Chairman, I think one of the missing House members was instrumental in seeing that it was in on the House side. He is not here today. And I would suggest, although I won't demand it, I would suggest that this matter be tabled until he can be present to carry on this discussion.
Okay, we'll put it on the next agenda. I'm inclined. I think three is the right one to also. So.
Yeah.
Okay, and I just for members, I happened to run into Representative Latz about a week ago and told him that the commission was going to take this up. And if I happen to run into Senator Kelly, I'm going to tell him also. Because I think a wiser decision will be made if everybody knows what's going on. Unlike what happened last year, where it was stuffed in a conference committee report in the dark of night, which is a terrible process for spending public dollars. Terrible process. And legislators who do that need to be reminded that that is not a good process for spending tax dollars. Shoving things in unrelated conference committee reports that have been dealt with in a thoughtful way by a commission. Okay, so we'll take that up in the next meeting. Are we 2239 and 2428? Are those bills...
Don't know.
Oh, I'm sorry. Two that we set aside yesterday because Ms. Kilberg wasn't here was revising investment authority on, I guess that one was for the Minneapolis teachers. And then 2428 was a Pappas bill we did talk about for reporting requirements and investment authority. And then the state auditor was in with some of her report recommendations. So how do we do this? Maybe we need to specifically deal with the state auditor's report and Senate File 2239 to resolve the issue that that is trying to deal with, and then go to the broader issues. So Ms. Kilberg?
Please, too.
Is she still here?
She is. She's in the back.
Ms. Kilberg?
Yes, she is.
And State Auditor's Office?
Yeah, right here.
Okay, State Auditor. So let's deal specifically with the portion of the State Auditor's Report and Senate File 2239, House File 2362 that deals with that issue and see if we can't get that resolved and then go to broader issues. Because I think the reason for 2239, 2362 was try to resolve something that the auditor's report had raised. Is that right, Ms. Kilberg? That bill tries to resolve something the auditor's report had raised. So maybe should we just have Ms. Kilberg talk about that bill first, or let's do that. Ms. Kilberg? So 2239, House File 2362, and it's behind the salmon sheet. Ms. Kilberg?
For the record, Mr. Chairman, Karen Kilberg, Minneapolis Teachers Retirement Fund Association. Our concern with the language that exists today is the fact that because of our funding situation and our liquidity needs to pay annuities, we as a fund have invested heavily in index funds. And that ability apparently is not available to us beyond the 35% limit of the alternative investment category. We worked with the state auditor last year to introduce a bill that would change that language, and that language has also been put forward this year, and we highly support that provision in the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We also support that language.
Okay, so where's that specific language?
Mr. Chair, it's on page 4. It's item 4.5 to 4.9. Set a file 2239.
Oh wait, is it the commingled funds above? Mm-hmm. So it's lines 4.4 to 4.9, right? That's what you said, I think.
That's correct.
Okay, so that appears to be consensus item. St. Paul doesn't have any trouble with that. Okay, so Representative Smith moves that we incorporate that portion of Senate File 2239. It's lines 4.5 to 4.9. Discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion adopted. Okay. Is there anything else in this bill that you want to try to pass this year or in 2239? Ms. Kilberg?
Mr. Chairman, members, again, we're not looking for sweeping changes in anything this year except for the fact that we're trying to resolve our funding issue. And so, if other funds have issues that they want to deal with, so be it. But our concern was mainly with our ability to be able to.
Okay, so is there anything in 2239 that the auditor's office would like to save for discussion?
Senator Pogomiller, we did work with Mr. Burek yesterday, and there are some overlapping bills, in particular the bill that Mr. Kapler had yesterday.
Right.
And this bill has similar language, and if you have another hearing, I believe parts of this bill and parts of the Kapler bill would be put together, and would be by consensus.
Is there a consensus on those items already? Oh, we're going to move to that next then. Ms. Kilberg, we have one last question for you. Do you need on page 5 the transition provision for what we just did, section 3?
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe we do, but it's always nice to have the option.
What do you think? Put it in? Okay. Representative Smith moves that we incorporate Section 3 also.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Burr?
Yep.
You have been making changes to 356A.06 subdivision 7, and that would have no effect on Minneapolis teachers unless you also adopted Section 1 of the bill, which changes the Minneapolis Teachers Investment Authority to Section 356A.06 subdivision 7. So you need subdivision 1.
Staff thinks we need subdivision 1, Ms. Gilbert? Does that make sense to you? Auditor's office is shaking their head, yes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's right.
Mr. Chairman, members, you have your way with us, however we do. I would not oppose that.
Okay. So that's part of the Smith motion also. Whatever language is needed to make this section work. And it looks like it's lines 1.5 to 1.8 and 5.7 to 5.10. Discussion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, aye. Motion adopted. Okay, then we do have, so Mr. Kepler, join us, and staff, you're going to walk us through their consensus items on the next bill and what's left of this bill, I guess. So let's try to adopt those if we can. Who wants to tell us where we are? Mr. Burke?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that we're at the stage where we have consensus items.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. Next meeting we will.
Okay, so we're not ready to go on this yet? Okay.
I think Mr. Bierker is working on redrafts.
Okay, then we'll set this aside. And if there's anything left in 2239, deal with that, and anything, and then 2428. So we'll set the rest aside. Okay, thank you, Mr. Kepler. Auditor, as long as you're there, let's go back to the auditor's investment recommendations then.
Mr. Chair, at the end of the last meeting, staff did go over this. I'd like to point out of the articles, some of these you've already dealt with in the last 2 days, so we would end up needing to pull out. Maybe if I could take them one by one. Again, I won't go over it because it was done late yesterday. Article 1 is something that would still need to be dealt with. Article 2, you did just pass the 5% cap on SBI, so SBI would be removed, but MRF, Fire, and Minneapolis Police would still be within the bill. Article 3, I believe, should be removed because you're dealing with Minneapolis teachers. You have several different proposals before you, and this was just my suggestion that if you do not consolidate Minneapolis teachers, that you need to increase the funding. Article 4, only Section 1 needs to be addressed because you just passed the MRF authority to invest in SBI. And Article 5 would still need to be addressed. So,
okay, then let's walk through. Why don't you take the first one? And
how much do you want me to go over it again, Mr. Chair?
Well,
philosophically, perhaps.
Okay.
The Article 1 is requiring the first-class teachers' funds to essentially come under and be treated the same way as all the large funds are under SBI, so that before increases could be given based on investment returns, the funds would need to get back into full funding. That's the same way that SBI and all the other retirees are treated across the state of Minnesota, and it's just making that consistent. And I could take questions on that. The Article 2 again.
Let's stay with Article 1 right now.
Okay.
Let's hear from three funds on Article 1. And this is a pretty fairly straightforward issue. Do we want to apply the 5% cap as we just are suggesting for the statewide funds? Do we want to go to the three teacher funds on that right now?
That's Article 2 is the 5% cap.
To recover Mr. losses. Chairman. Oh, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, Article 1 does include 5% cap language for these three first.
Well, how do Article 1 and 2 interrelate here? I'm sorry.
Article 1 creates...
Yeah, Article 1 is the first-class city teachers.
And it's creating an SBI-like post fund for them and capping it at 5%.
Okay.
And Article 2...
Is others. Okay.
Article 2 does it for the State Board of Investment Fund, which has been dealt with already, plus...
But it has Minneapolis police
dealt with, and also the two Minneapolis and Fire Police Relief Associations.
Okay, so the issues are for the teachers right now. The issues are the 5% cap and a post fund. Right. So,
Mr. Chair, Jay Stoffel, Duluth Teachers. The issue is a little bit more complicated than a simple 5% cap, and you know, what does creation of a post retirement fund mean? That's a significant issue for our funds, I think, especially. I mean, I'm speaking for Duluth Teachers, but I think it's true for all three of the first-class city teacher funds. We don't have a post-retirement fund. That is a significant change in the way we operate our pension fund, creating a second fund just of retiree assets. That has very significant actuarial implications. I think we need an actuarial analysis of what that means, what that does to our funding ratio, what that does to our deficiency ratio. My rough calculations indicate that our funding would go from 86% down to about 69 or 70% in our active, you know, member plan. Our post-retirement fund would be 100% funded the day we create it. So those are the things that I'm implying, that this is a serious policy issue, a significant deviation from the way that we're administering the plan. Creating a post fund is a very significant issue. So having said that, we understand the policy reasons for having a 5% cap, and we would like to be involved in a discussion on how to do that with our pension fund, maybe without creating a post-retirement fund. I have one or two ideas on how we can accomplish that without creating a post fund. I'd like to discuss that. And study that, other alternatives. I think the post-retirement fund may be a little bit of a drastic, it's maybe in line with consistency and uniformity, but I think you need to understand the implications, the actuarial implications of doing that and creating a post fund in our plans.
Thank you. Mr. Kepler.
Mr. Chairman, members, St. Paul Teachers' position would be very similar. I think that the fact of doing sort of a structural change in the way that the fund is designed could have a very strange effect on the funded status of the plan, segregate the assets all over on the retiree side. In effect, we think that the post fund mechanism or the post fund structure for the state is a very strange arrangement altogether. It's kind of an anachronism on the pension funding landscape in the public world generally, to segregate the assets for retirees away from the active members and create a sort of quasi-defined contribution arrangement whereby, you know, retirees capture excess investment earnings for those portion of assets once segregated and they're not available to revert back or plow back into the plan to either reduce costs or take care of unfunded liabilities or enhance benefits in any other way. We've got one pool of liabilities and one pool of assets, and that's a structure that makes more sense, and it's the one that prevails just about everywhere else. So we don't happen to think that's the model to be extending to anybody, though we do think that the auditor's office has raised some interesting issues. I think the structure of our post-retirement benefit increase formula right now is something that our board has concerns about, and similar to Mr. Stoffel, I think we'd like to be engaged in a discussion about how we go about capping out those liabilities and prevent the clear, as the auditor has pointed out, leakage that occurs from the fund, the way that the post-retirement formula now works. It's not pegged to cost of living cleanly, and I think the primary public policy objective once a person retires is to make sure that their benefit doesn't deteriorate in purchasing power to the extent that we can as model employers. Beyond that, we don't want people to be getting rich in retirement out of these programs. I don't think that's what they were set up for. And we don't want their benefit to deteriorate relative to inflation. So it's finding that middle ground is our objective.
Thank you. Ms. Kilberg.
Mr. Chairman, members, Karen Kilberg, Minneapolis Teachers Retirement Fund. We are hoping that this will be a non-issue for us because you are going to pass a bill this year that will do the consolidation with TRA. However, if that does not happen, I do have a couple of concerns, and I think Mr. Burek in his memo has brought them up. One is we do not have enough assets to come anywhere close to funding a post fund, which means that if you do that, you would be taking away for the foreseeable future any possibility that anybody in the Minneapolis Teachers Retirement Fund would ever have increase, post-retirement increase, other than the 2%. The other concern I have, and again, Mr. Burek has pointed it out, is what happens from a federal standpoint. As you know, our plans have been grandfathered with the post-retirement adjustments that they currently have, and I'm not sure that making this change would even be possible from that standpoint. They could say that if we're going to change the plan to the post fund, that's not a possibility, and the only thing that we would be able to do then would have some structure that would simply give us a cost of living increase. So I think that there are implications beyond what we here in the state of Minnesota would like to do. But again, I am not opposed to a 5% cap at all for our fund if we were to go forward. But my hope is that it will be a non-issue for us.
Okay. You want to add anything? Or?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we can get the 5% cap, I'll be happy with that as a compromise. Thanks. For now.
I think the way to deal with that is if these other funds were willing to come up with something this year, or able to come up with something this year that their boards were comfortable with, that probably could be part of a larger package. Is that realistic at all for your two boards or not?
Mr. Chairman, members, I don't know that there's any particular urgency to doing that. It is confounding relative to the current regulations and the grandfathering of our benefits, our post-retirement benefits formula as it exists now. If we do anything to that, then we have to conform to the regs which specify that you can have a guaranteed COLA, you can have an investment-related, you can have CPI, but you can't have a paired post-retirement increase formula. I think it's too important of an issue to move too quickly on now.
How about could the commission at least ask you to kind of work with the auditor's office and see if there isn't a potential to do something as other things happen this year? If, for example, we do pass a consolidation of the Minneapolis fund and a 5% cap for the statewide funds, it's not like we have to do the five, we would have to do it for your funds, but if it fit nicely, I think it would probably be a consensus at that point. But I think if we pass a statewide cap, it's not going to be too long before it applies broader.
I think the auditor's already got our board on board with the concept of somehow capping off.
Well, why don't you guys have some discussions with the auditor's office and see if there's a possibility to fit it in this year at some point. I think, am I speaking for the commission? I think we'd rather do it if the local funds were on board, rather than saying they're not ready, but we're going to do it anyway. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I think there's consensus on the 5% cap issue. There's not consensus about getting to the point where they're fully funded before there's increases above inflation or above the 2.5. That's the part where there isn't consensus, because that would force them to create a post fund like SBI. But on the 5% cap issue, I think there is consensus.
Well, I'm getting a sense that they think it's intermingled somehow. So anyhow, we're I don't think the commission's ready to. It was a big step to get it on the three statewide funds today. I think if there's a possibility that we could fit it in as we move along here in the next month and a half, I think that commission would be open to that. So, all right, let's move to. I think it would have to be the funds basically saying we're ready to go on that. I think that would help, yeah. Auditor. We're not looking for adding weight to the pension bill this year that's going to create opposition. Okay, page 9, Article 2. We dealt with, I think the same thing would happen with Well, we already talked about MRF a little bit and the 5%, but Minneapolis Police and Fire Relief, I'm guessing, let's find out if there's any openness to the 5% cap.
Mr. Chairman, Brian Rice, I'm the General Counsel of Police Relief Association, Fire Relief Association. Both of our boards just recently became aware of it. Both of them would be adamantly opposed to it. The concept that we have now is a 13th check or post-retirement benefit, which is not a permanent increase based on investment-related gains. In 1989 and 90, when this whole issue about the post fund was talked about and investment-related gains, the current formula was put in place. The state funds and teachers, and actually the teachers came in later, but the SBI went in this direction of adding permanent increases based on investment gains. At the time, quite frankly, our clients were underfunded and said, we can't afford it, add too much liability. We have a contingent benefit. It's not permanent. It happens annually if we make it or don't make it. We haven't paid one for years. And the solution that the auditor is coming up, it doesn't fit the situation. I mean, we haven't paid a 13th check or a PRB, we meaning police and fire, for 3 or 4 years. It's totally different than what the state's done. There's a $4 billion deficit in the state post fund now because they paid permanent benefits on investment gains that are no longer there. We don't have the same situation. You have to earn it. It's one time. It's not a permanent addition to the benefit increase, and we'd submit it.
Right, I think we know that much. Yeah. I think
we don't think it fits. Bad idea.
Adamant opposition.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks. All right. Why don't we then go to on Article 3, is your recommendation, you think that there should be some direct state aid to help solve that problem, or does this reflect what was in your recommendation? We know you're part of the overall discussion with the House on how to get at this. I'm just curious.
Senator Pogamiller, my recommendation is that the legislature solve the problem somehow this year, and that was what was in there. If it is not done, and I think a consolidation is the correct way to do that. Okay. If that's not done, though, Minneapolis Teachers is going to need another source of funding at some point somehow because they're...
What is your thinking in terms of adding state money to help the solution? Are you an agnostic on that, or... Or do you think that's going to be necessary ultimately? Or I'm just trying to get a sense. And you may not have a view on it. I don't know.
Representative Thiessen and others are working on proposals. I've had many discussions with them. I haven't seen any final language. And it's all going to be a big question.
Well, we appreciate your help.
Thank you.
Because it would be good to get it done. Mm-hmm. Okay, Article 4 then?
Only Section 1 needs to be dealt with.
Okay. What does that do?
This allows the first-class teacher plans to also do what you just allowed MRF to do, which is to invest in SBI supplemental fund.
First-class teacher plans?
Does it allow them or make them?
I think it was in the Minneapolis bill, so I think they're for it. But, no, this applies to all three.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Jay Stoffel, Director of Duluth Teachers. This is authorizing language. I think we're in favor of this type of language and may actually broaden it to include some other funds beyond the supplemental plan.
St. Paul?
Mr. Chair, members, we wouldn't be opposed to extended authority to participate in supplemental fund, no.
Would you be supportive?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Representative Smith moves that Section 1 of Article 4 be incorporated. Discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Aye. Motion adopted. Okay, then Article 5.
So this would need to be discussed. This essentially caps or sets up an administrative expense process with Minneapolis Police, Minneapolis Fire. I'm sure they're opposed to this heavily, and you can probably hear from Mr. Rice regarding that regard.
Why don't you give us your thinking on it from the
essentially, as it's in your packet, both of these two plans have extremely excessive administrative expenses. There's a chart that's attached to the bill. It's many, many times what is spent in para, police, and fire. Down the road can only get hire. This exists for Minneapolis teachers currently. We think that something needs to be looked at and done, and I think the problem that exists within these plans is as these administrative expenses are higher, ultimately it's the taxpayers of the city of Minneapolis that are paying this bill. And we would just urge you to consider doing something about the excess costs here.
Okay, members, you want to look at where about in the packet is that? About a one-third of the way in. It's a page 12. It isn't actually page 12, but it's a chart that looks like this. I presume that's from the auditor's report.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Minneapolis Police and Fire Funds.
Mr. Chairman, Brian Rice again for Minneapolis Police and Fire. The boards also would oppose this. First off, we think the comparisons the auditor drew in the report are grossly unfair. Both of these funds are closed funds. They've been closed to new members since 1980, which is 26 years ago. They have had no new members coming in. And as their comparison group, the state auditor includes PRA Police and Fire, which is an open fund, which has members hired since then from Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. So we don't think it's a fair comparison. The legislature made a policy decision to close these plans in 1980. That was a decision the legislature made. There was another decision made in the mid-80s that allowed for a method of voluntary consolidation of these plans into PRA that involved an election that members got to make those decisions. And by virtue of the fact of closing the fund, you obviously were going to increase administrative expenses. No new members coming in, members dying every month. Inflation being what it is, costs going up, necessarily you've created a formula that's going to drive higher administrative expenses. The auditor said these are, I think it grows excessive administrative fees. I would disagree. I think the plans are well run. To run a plan, a freestanding plan, you're going to have an executive director, a board, investment costs, rent, certain other expenses that just come with running a fund. The legislature made a decision in 80 to allow these plans to remain freestanding, and in the mid-80s said if you want to consolidate, you have that option, and we'll let you do it. Most plans have, some have not. That's one point. First, I don't think it's a fair comparison at all. Secondly, it would violate prior legislative directives that gave members these rights to do it. And then thirdly, her bill would have our administrative expenses include investment-related expenses. Now, I don't know exactly how PRA calculated, but as I understand it, SBI runs the money for the state plans, and PRA administers the benefit programs. So that's another apples-to-oranges comparison that she would make. She would saddle these funds with investment expenses compared to PRA when PRA doesn't have investment-related expenses. They have a growing membership base, and these funds don't. I think when you look at the administrative expenses of these plans, they generally run about $600,000 to $700,000. I think to run a pension plan, that's about what it costs in the state to run one, whether it's teachers, first-class teachers, other ones. She's said this. It comes from the teacher plan thing.
Mr. Rice, why don't you say the auditor's report?
The auditor's report uses the teacher plan provision. I worked on that teacher plan provision, and I don't believe that this bill, in fact, mirrors that bill at all in terms of its cost components. And also, at least in the teacher plan, you had a compare. The theory there was the local plans were inefficient, the state's better. Those plans aren't paying it because TRA's administrative expenses are way more than, I know, St. Paul's and Minneapolis's and Duluth's. So the theory that big is better or cheaper didn't bear out in that circumstance. And I think the teachers in those plans are not paying this administrative provision because, in fact, they're running more efficiently than TRA. I know certainly on the investment-related side, if you would add that and each member would have to pay it, I think on the administrative side alone, you'd be reducing these members' pensions by $1,000 a year, and if you add in investment expenses, it's probably cutting their pensions by $2,000 a year. So, I mean, this auditor's bill is effectively a reduction in pension payments to retired Minneapolis police and firefighters, their survivors, and spouses and widows by, I would say, $2,500 a year. That's what she's asking you to do, and I think you should reject it.
But she's still higher than both of them. Okay, questions?
Mr. Perl, I'd just like to point out that MRF is also a closed fund and has administrative expenses in line with the others. The difference here is about eight times as high. It's not slightly, it's eight times as high. But I think it should be brought to your
what are
attention.
Let's take MRF as an example. What are the, from the, does the auditor's report identify what are the differences that cause those different causes? What, is there a roadmap to how one would, if it's possible to bring those together, is there a roadmap how to do that?
How to do what?
To what are there particular expenses in police and fire, Minneapolis police and fire, that the auditor's report found to not be justifiable?
Mr. Pogamilla, I think we pointed out the legal expenses. Yeah, legal expenses, which included lobbying costs.
Okay.
Was where we found that there were extreme excessive costs as compared to any other pension plan.
Legal costs and lobbying costs are higher. In part, I'm very grateful for the auditor here because she keeps me very busy by coming up with reports like this. And she's generated a number of reports that have had, I would submit, inaccurate information. We've had ongoing disputes with them about the quality of the reports they've made. And I guess I'm the beneficiary of it because the fund needs to defend itself against misinformation.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if the executive director could come up real quick. Mr. Rice, why don't you sit back? This kind of, you're in kind of an awkward
sure,
position.
Sure, I am.
Why don't you give us your take on why there are some differences and why, in your judgment, they might be justifiable, and are there some things you're doing to tighten up? And why don't you just give the commission a sense of, I don't think it's good enough just to say we're going to ignore this. I think we need a better flavor for what's going on based on the data that auditor office published.
Okay, Renee Tessier, Executive Director of the Minneapolis Police Relief Association. 2004, we did have high legal fees. We are still in a...
And this is Minneapolis Police now.
Minneapolis Police.
Yeah.
With the Contreras Mortgage Technomar issue, we still have that.
But Technomar?
Yes. In 2005, our unaudited numbers shows that the direct investment fees are down 30%. And the administrative costs are now down 23% from the 2004 numbers.
So in the next audit, this bar chart will come down?
Correct.
What range do you think it'll be in at that point, or are you not in a position to exactly know?
I don't know that correct today.
Based on what you know, is it cutting it in half or a third, or do you have any back of the envelope sense of how significant? It's hard for us to judge
correct.
What those reductions you just described, what does that mean in terms of this?
I would say maybe a third.
Questions for Ms. Tessier?
Any information on what it was in 2003 or 2002? I mean, is there a similar chart to this?
I don't have them available.
Maybe did the auditor's report have a timeline on this? Has it been going up or down, or do you have that information from previous reports or anything?
This is a what? Different reports. Is that right? Yeah. Yep. Mr. Chair, it's always been high. This is just 1 year's worth of data.
Why don't you, could the
previous auditors didn't run these numbers either.
Would it be too mm-hmm. difficult for the staff to put together a timeline on this just to show us what's
mm-hmm.
going on?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thanks. Were there some in the past, and while you're doing that, if there were some in the past that were high that have come down, maybe that would help us understand what the possibilities are there.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to make sure, I think members heard it's a closed fund. There's a potential that that tends to be higher.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, mm-hmm. Ms. Johnson, could you join us real quick? I'm trying to create conflict here. I'm trying to see if there's not... Thank you,
okay.
Ms. Tessier. I appreciate it. Do you have any sense, Ms. Johnson, why yours would be so much lower than theirs? Because you're also a closed fund, or just, and you may not know the differences. I'm not trying to put you in a difficult position. I'm just trying to get a sense of, you know, you have some background and expertise here.
Mr. Chair, I've now worked for the fund for 10 years, and our expenses are roughly the same because one of our priorities is to not have our fund expenses go up. In other words, as our membership declines, which it does because we're a closed fund, right, we actually cut the budget. And so then we spend within that framework. So actually, 15 years ago, our administrative costs were over $1.8 million. Now they're $700,000. But it's because it's been one of my top priorities. One of the commitments to the fund is that I will find savings every year so that if the membership drops 3%, I make sure our total administrative costs drop 3%. We have a proposal now to take payroll in-house, which will save us another $80,000, which will actually then drop our expenses greatly more. It will be back down around $600,000. So part of it is that commitment. Now, how do we do it? We laid off half of our staff when I took over, and we cross-trained our people. The group that got laid off, frankly, was administrative secretaries. And so I have three full-time staff people, myself, and a part-time person whose hours go down as our membership retires. In other words, we structured his job that way. The other key piece, though, is we're not involved in litigation, and when we are, I'm a CPA and an attorney. And so, and again, this is a policy decision. Our board has felt comfortable with me handling those duties as part of my job.
So you're actually doing the legal work for them?
So I'm actually doing a great deal of legal work for them that's standard legal work and only.
Yeah, but if you had a Technomar situation, you wouldn't do that legal
and
work.
And so that's exactly right. Because the legal work I'm doing is on disability cases, okay, on divorces, on things where I came in with an expertise, and we use our outside counsel very sparingly. On the CPA side, the same is true. We don't use consultants on the accounting aspect of it. I do that work because I actually have more experience than the staff. So to some extent, it's unique to the fact that you have a director with this kind of background, and there's only so many people that do. And then the other thing is it's a high priority to the board. You have to keep in mind that our expenses are not paid by the fund. I have to issue a bill to the city and the schools. And so I'm mindful. When we had reduction in LGA, I took less than full-time pay for 2 years because I knew that the city was doing the same thing. It's a little different situation when you're billing the municipality than if the fund is just absorbing those costs. And I think we're the only one that has that in our law.
How many people, how many members are you covering still?
We have 5,000 retired members and 400, roughly 450 actives, and about 200 deferred.
So 5,700 folks you're dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
What's, Ms. Tessa, what are you dealing with now in terms of total numbers of people?
927.
927. So that in and of itself affects, just the size of those numbers affects the per member cost pretty dramatically. Okay. Is thank you very much.
Okay.
Any questions? Thank you. Appreciate it. Is anybody from fire here other than Mr. Rice? Okay. Mr. Rice, anything to point out on the fire one that's different? They didn't have a Technomar and stuff. Just 1 second.
Well, again, Mr. Chairman, I'd submit that the auditor's chosen a per-member cost. Another way to look at it is expense ratio assets.
We have that point. I'm just wondering if there's any special circumstances in the fire. How many members is the fire fund
covering?
There's
600. And
600, so it's even a smaller
640.
Number?
640. It's smaller yet.
640.
And again, to run a fund, you have to do it. I don't know. I haven't looked at these numbers. Some funds, and the commission should be aware of it, have a soft dollar component. And I don't know if the auditors look for this. Some funds can use soft dollars to buy down their administrative expenses. The police and fire don't. I don't know if the other funds did or how they looked at that report. That money can be significant. And it's used by other funds, both in the state and around the country, to lower the apparent administrative costs. And I don't know if that's been looked at or part of this study.
They should bring them down. Great. Questions for Mr. Rice? Okay. Auditor?
I'll just make one more point. Well, first of all, the bill as it's before you does exclude litigation from the cap in Minneapolis. They are in litigation, and they're going to be in more soon, I understand. I think From my perspective, the way I see this is there is no incentive for these two funds to keep to their administrative expenses in check whatsoever. Their benefit is based on union contracts. It's tied to union contracts. The city of Minneapolis has to pay, make up the funding difference, and so there is no incentive for them to keep it down. And in fact, there's going to be a dilemma if they're in legal issues with the city of Minneapolis. The city of Minneapolis ultimately has to pay their legal bills, even if they're litigating against each other indirectly. And I think it's because of that, I think it puts a burden of hardship on the city of Minneapolis, who's already putting millions of dollars into this fund, and they're going to end up having to put more millions of dollars into this fund. So I think I'm looking for some sort of solution to help incentivize these funds to keep their expenses down, or at a minimum to keep them reasonable. And I would say they're not even close to being reasonable.
Ms. Tessier, what's the total number that's in this bar? We know it's $800 per member. What is that number?
How much money are we talking about?
He has not talked about that.
Or maybe.
Anybody know?
Is it $1 million or?
You know?
I think it's $700,000.
Mm-hmm. So that bar represents $700,000. Okay.
That is paid for directly or indirectly by the city of Minneapolis.
Okay. Commission members, I'll speak for myself. I think I'm not alarmed, but I'm concerned, and I think the funds need to be paying some attention, and at least we know the fire is. I'm willing to wait another year and see what happens, but obviously we'll do whatever the commission wants to do. The auditor has done her job. Is anybody okay? I think we're going to probably wait.
That's fine.
And
thank you.
Not do anything this year on it. But I think it is fair that the funds need to pay some attention. We'll probably come up again. So
thank you.
Thank you. Really appreciate your work on this. We're very close here, members, for today at least. I think we've dealt with everything but the omnibus. Okay, let's go to number 9. House, looking for your direction. I think the House is comfortable with the first three now, aren't you? Contribution increases. We talked about those earlier in the session here. So not the first three, I'm sorry.
Article 1 is the contribution increases.
Yeah, just the first bullet there. The first bullet. Am I right there, Representative Smith, that is something the House is probably ready to go forward with this year? On the phased plan that we had decided with the general funds?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Okay, so Smith moves that be incorporated in some fashion. Members and stakeholders in the audience, it is unclear how we're going to proceed bills this year. It may be that the House will pick up one of the files they have and do some things with that. But obviously the Senate has to pass anything that hasn't been passed yet. So I don't think we've quite decided how we're going to do all these bills, but there will be a non-controversial or a basically agreed-to package that the Senate will pass. That's the one we've been adding things to. And then whether something like this item is in that package or not, it'll really be the call of the House. If they're comfortable with that in that package, I think we'd add it to that package. If the House would like to have that in a separate package, we'd deal with that in some fashion. And that would either be picking up the House file that you already have or some other mechanism. Representative Smith and I have talked about this, and I think that's a general approach we're trying to
yes.
We're trying to figure out a way for the House and the Senate to get along here and move a bunch of stuff forward. Mr. Martin?
Members, I do have for your benefit, if that's the way you choose to view it, a technical amendment drawn to 1057, which simply attempts to update the fact that 1057 was drawn last year.
Okay.
It also better handles, I think, the MSRS contribution rate increases by placing them, rather than in a more narrative form, put them into a table with each increase. Mr. Bergstrom, I believe, is going to want to address your having to do with the state patrol, where he initially thought he could do it in two increments and apparently needs three increments. This amendment does not do the three increments.
Okay.
It just does the two.
Mr. Bergstrom, where would that be in here?
I suspect we're talking about page 2 of the amendment. On lines 2.17 through 2.22 would be, I think, the member rate contribution for the state patrol. The other thing that the A1 amendment does is cleans up the effective dates and things in the second article, primarily the Minneapolis teacher consolidation. There were a lot of 2005 effective dates that now, of necessity, have to become 2006 effective dates.
Okay.
So just this is for your benefit. Since I don't know how you're going to proceed, this is our recommendation how to clean up the language to make it technically correct.
Okay, and House, the way we will, just so people are comfortable, we will have bills that are there that people can see, and we'll have a week or two or three to look at. So we're not, the intent here is not to move things so people don't have a chance to see it. We'll get them structured in a way where we think the House and the Senate can best work on this stuff, and we'll make sure it gets out in an orderly fashion so people have a chance to review the language on all of these items. So, Mr. Bergstrom, what do you need a third step on the patrol?
Mr. Chair, at the last meeting when we talked about the contribution increases, you asked me to have our actuary look at how the assumption changes you adopted fit with the most recent valuation, and I did that, and I have attached a letter from Mercer Human Resources regarding that, and they are recommending that we go to 26.3% of pay for the state patrol plan. To get there, we are proposing a third step onto what we had proposed before, effective July 1 of 2009, going to an employee contribution of 10.4 in 15.6%. So, Mr. Chair, I'm providing you with the data to do that, and then the recommended change. And Mr. Chair, also, the other thing our board is interested in, and I don't know if you have the amendment, Mr. Burke, but was the same authority that PERA was granted to turn off and on increases within certain parameters. And we would be interested in that.
I've got an amendment to do that.
Let's see it. Okay, so Representative Smith moves that we would add the third step on page 2 there to 10.4. I guess I'll go after line 2.20.
With the necessary adaptation. Members, also after 2.28, you would there would be a third step there, which would go from 14.6 to 15.6.
Okay.
Pursuant to the MSRS actuary.
Okay. And that would be incorporated in the Smith motion. Is this the stakeholder group is comfortable with this?
Mr. Chair, I believe they are.
Okay.
I have not heard of any.
Will you double check?
I will, yes.
Okay. Okay, so let's do that first on the Smith motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All
aye.
Opposed, motion adopted. Okay, Mr. Burke, A1.
Mr. Chairman, this is an amendment that MSRS had requested, and what this amendment would do is it would put in place for MSRS General, MSRS Correctional, and MSRS State Patrol Plan an automatic mechanism to adjust the contribution rates if there is a contribution deficiency or contribution sufficiency that exists for more than 2 years. This procedure is patterned after the procedure that was enacted last year for the para plans.
Why didn't we do it for you last year?
You didn't ask for it.
Mr. Chair, I didn't ask for it. Yeah. It was a brilliant idea that she had, and I am just copying it. So, but, Mr. Chair, really what it does is, you know, if the returns are stronger or weaker, it allows us to do an adjustment within certain parameters, and I believe it actually gives the legislature time to not go along with it if they so choose.
Right, I remember the decision.
So choose.
Steve, you comfortable with that?
Yes.
Smith moves the A1, which also includes the language we just adopted.
Right.
Discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All
aye.
Opposed, motion adopted. Okay, so then we have the A1 all the way up to, where's the Minneapolis stuff start here?
H3 starts the Minneapolis.
Okay, so first two pages, Smith moves to incorporate in the bullet one here under number 9. Discussion, all in favor say aye.
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 All opposed, motion adopted. Okay, so then the motion is that bullet one be incorporated as amended. This is bullet one under number 9. All do we need to update the other ones, or this is in good shape now? Okay, on that motion by Smith, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted. Okay, teacher retirement restructuring, we'll wait on that. Special pre-69s, we'll wait. Pension default insurance pool.
That was DePaul's thing.
I think that was kind of an idea that would be in a larger package. I don't think it needed to be separate, or is that?
This is the early.
Is that? Remind me, is that something I came up with?
Members, the pension default insurance pool was something that the commission staff came up
yes,
with.
Okay.
Requested by the chair to try and find other vehicles that could avoid difficulties that may occur if the Minneapolis teachers plan or some other pension plan were to run out of money.
I remember this.
At a point in time, not when a legislative session was going on and when there was not an easy way to try and bridge the gap.
Okay, well, I would just encourage the House to look at that as part of their whole teacher thing. I think that was a pretty good idea. It came from staff. But had you looked, did you even notice it was still in there?
This was where we put a surcharge on
members, it's funded on a per capita charge on plan membership, yes.
So I just encourage the House to think about that as part of their package. Any fund directors or anybody have a further thought on that one?
Yeah, they don't like it.
They don't like it.
Mr. Chair, Dave Bergstrom, the director of the state retirement system. We don't think, or I guess I don't think, and I don't believe any of the other fund directors.
Vanek is saying she's with you on this
one. Yeah, and I'm pretty
Mr.
sure.
Mr. Thompson said he's with you on this one.
I think they've got my back, thanks, from Mr. Chair. It raises an insignificant amount of money in relationship to what we would need. I don't remember the exact calculation, but I think last year it would have taken 20-some years to cover 1 month of the MSRS retiree pay. You would have to collect this fee for 20-some years to cover 1 month of our payroll. And, Mr. Chair, I think it raises some legal issues, too, about using money from one fund to offset the cost of another fund. When the guarantee, when under the private pension plan, employers actually pay a fee into that guarantee corporation. They don't take the assets out of the fund. And I think that's a big distinction legally of using funds from one plan to help fund another. I don't think that is something that would withstand a legal challenge.
Any thoughts on, is there something else we should be considering to get at the problem?
Mr. Chair, what you just did for the MSRS retirement funds is the key, is making sure they're properly funded. And I think, you know, that provision that gives us the flexibility to adjust them really makes a lot of sense.
But aren't we in a situation where this is meant to solve a problem where legislatures and governors don't get it done? So give some thought to it.
Mr. Chair, I will, but thank you.
Okay. Deferred annuities augmentation.
Members, Minnesota is somewhat unique in providing an automatic increase in the benefits to members who are no longer active public employees, deferred annuitants. Someone who's vested but not the age to actually draw a benefit has their benefit automatically increased 3% or 5% under current
right, the law. Funds were all for this, weren't they?
The plans would like to, in some cases, reduce the amount of the augmentation rates, and indeed you did that for the privatization chapters in yesterday's action. This proposal goes beyond where the pension funds have recommended changes. PERA has been the plan that has been trying to reduce the augmentation rate. This totally eliminates the augmentation rate for new hires.
Right.
Mr. Chair and members, the fund directors did discuss this, and while the para board came forward with a reduction to 2.5% up to 55 and nothing thereafter, all the funds have agreed that a 2.5% for all years of deferral is a reasonable compromise on this issue for prospective members of the plans.
All the funds meaning?
First Class City Teacher Funds, MRF, MSRS, TRA, para.
It's a miracle. It's a miracle. Smith moves that we amend the what's in that Omnibus 2 bill to be a 2.5% for each year. Does staff understand? Okay. And that we incorporate that in the first bill, hopefully. Steve, you come forward?
Yes.
Discussion? Anybody want to testify on that? So it's not just new hires now, it's everybody. Four new hires.
Perspective.
Okay, the 2.5 for four new hires. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Luther Thompson, TRA. No, I think this is a much more important issue, you know, for TRA. We would certainly would have opposed, you know, eliminating it or reducing it, because we have a large amount of, you know, members that may leave, and they certainly have a vested interest in the fund. And
okay. What date are we starting this?
July 1, 2006. Mr. Chair, I believe the effective date of the bill, July 1, I would assume.
July 1, 2006.
It's easier for us to start at the beginning of a new fiscal.
Okay. Kilberg and everybody, does that work for the teacher funds? Kepler? I don't see him. Okay. I don't see Mr. Kepler anymore. He'll be okay with that date? Okay. Oh, there he is. Okay. Smith makes that motion. That language will be drafted by staff, incorporated. Discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion adopted. Increased maximum retirement plan covered salary figure.
Members, this was actually handled last session outside of the pension commission. There was work done on limits on local public employee covered salary limits, and as part of that, a bill by Representative Earhart, I think Senator Steve Kelly, did away with this provision.
That got some media coverage, didn't it?
So this is not an issue that you need to deal with now.
That's what led to the everybody in Hennepin County is getting salary increases, isn't that the provision? I think it did, yeah. Okay. Early retirement incentive for state employees, Article 7. Where was the House? That was all pretty much
we have amendments, but that was all up to the
management and labor to come to an agreement.
Members
seem painless.
What I'm passing out is
I have to give a little disclosure. The Pensions Commission staff isn't as enthusiastic about this one as I am. I tried to cover their back on other stuff, but this one, they keep trying to undercut me.
Members, this is not a commission staff amendment. This is Mr. Fleming, who is attempting, as I understand it, to try and better target his incentive. And it also removes some portions of the 2005 language, since they were already included, or comparable provisions were included in the State Department's Appropriations Bill in 2005. So this strips down the early retirement incentive to literally an early retirement incentive, and apparently better targets it than Mr. Fleming.
Briefly, Mr. Fleming, what would this leave? What would be the provision then?
Mr. Chairman, if I would, the A1 amendment you have in front of you should be on page 5, line 5-3. You should add before 17, 9 and 11, lines 9 and 11.
Page 5? We don't have a page 5.
A1 on your amendment, the large amendment to 1057, which was the vehicle.
Oh, okay, okay.
Bill, which you're
A1, page 5. Okay.
The 5-3 line, you should add lines 9 and 11.
Okay, we haven't adopted that page yet. Is that the only piece you need?
Then we should, the lines 5, 4, and 6, you should delete those three, because what happened is
Well, no, we don't need that. All you need is
5.3, you need to add 9 and 11.
Okay, and then that covers everything that is necessary out of this amendment?
It does not.
Okay.
Because there's been a further enactment in the State Department's bill last year that Senator Larson's bill, Senate File 1845, was incorporated into 1481, the House file, now Chapter 156. So the correct amendment after that would be to delete Sections 2 to 5 and page 91 and 95. And the reason for that is that those are covered in the...
I think that's on 1.14 of this one-pager, what
correct.
You just said.
That's the amendment we'd love to talk to you about.
Okay. So now we're incorporating this 5.3 from A1 onto this amendment?
Yes, sir.
So the whole thing we're dealing with now is what's left.
Yes,
and why don't you tell us what's left?
What's left is this short page, the one you have in
right.
front of you, has new language and is visiting with Mr. Martin. And what it does is it targets and hopefully makes certain that there has to be savings. And the point when someone is no longer leave state service or unemployed is it costs about $23,000 to let them go if they have to move. And there's an incentive of $17,000 that could be paid in that stead. Last session, there was a, in the normal session, there was a fiscal note given which said that there's savings on this enactment net over $8 million to the 09 fiscal year, which was a fiscal note used in the Tax Conference Committee. So this
okay, Mr. Fleming, I think, slow down.
Yes, sir.
Where do we look in 1057?
On 1057, Article 7.
Page what? Page 90. Page 90. Just wait 1 second, Mr.
Yes,
Mr. Fleming.
Page
90, members, you want to look at Article 7 and this amendment we have.
Correct.
And that's so most of it's technical. Delete Sections 2 and 5 out of this. So post-retirement employment is gone. Section 5. This is the last item we're dealing with today, members.
Sections 2, 3, 4, and 5 are gone.
2, 3, 4, and 5.
Covered in Senator Larson's enactment in the State Department's bill during the normal session, Rule 5.
Okay, so that all is left is a page and a half. So it's page 90 and page 91 up to line 19 with this language.
Yes, sir.
Okay. That's what we're talking about right now, members.
Members, the language that Mr. Fleming has, there are two substantive changes, as I see it. One is it expands the incentive to include MNSCU, and that's your page 90 after line 6 line. And then if you go down to the new underscored language in the middle of the page, it provides some targeting language, which requires that there actually be a reduction in staff or a reorganization where there are budget shortfalls that trigger the incentive so that it's not offered to employees without reference to a budgetary or economic need to help an agency.
And this is only this nothing mandatory about this. This can only happen if the management agrees with the employee to do it. Is that right, Mr. Fleming?
Page 90, line 7, list all the employing organizations or units of government that could, and it says may
right.
offer. And our representation to you would be as you rely on the Department of Finance and their fiscal note, though it is somewhat changed by the enactment of Sections 2, 3, 4, and 5 in the normal session, the fiscal note has net savings going forward.
What's a normal session?
Do you know how much?
The fiscal note said, in summary, and this is without the school districts, it would be greater than this, I would hope and guess, that it has a cost of $3 million in 05, so forget that, push forward, but in 3.1 in 06, net 900,000 in 07, net $3.8 million in 08, net $9.7 million in 09.
Savings to
8. Savings.
So the savings is a little over $8 million, and during the special session in the Tax Conference Committee, this is one of the enhancement budget lines that was in the Senate file 29, which was laid in the table substituted in the enactment of the 13th of July.
Okay, just to get this in shape, Bedsill moves that this language be incorporated in page 90 and 91, just as amended. Discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted. Okay, what's the House's sense here? What do you know enough about this at this point to incorporate, or do you want to cogitate?
If I may, Mr. Chairman, cogitate. I would like to thank Representative Smith and Murphy for being the second, third author with Mr. Powell.
You love this.
In House File 1120, which is the companion to your Senate File 1057, which became the vehicle for the omnibus bill.
I guess we love it.
Do you want to think about it, Tim?
Mr. Chair, is there anybody that
anybody want
to
testify?
To
yes, sir.
Anybody want to testify?
There were a couple puzzled expressions on faces.
Is it? What's the administration's position on this now? Mr. Fleming?
Senator Polgemiller, I can't speak for the administration.
Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brian Bergson, lobbyist for the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees. Very quickly, due to the time, we are very much in support of this and have been working on it for many years. When it was first proposed, the administration back it was 1999 or 2000, was very much against it. And then they, as you saw last year, came back with their own proposal. So I don't know where they stand specifically on this provision, but they have come around on doing some incentives. Our board has taken a position in favor of it and are hopeful that the commission passes it.
Welcome.
My name is Jim McCain. I'm a business agent for Middle Management Association. I'll just say that our organization does support this proposal. We think it's an added tool for at least state managers and perhaps other governments to use when there is downsizing expected.
I can't remember.
That was before this amendment.
What about you?
I think so. Mr. Chairman, I think that would be a good idea. Also, I want to thank Mr. Fleming for pointing out that Representative Murphy and Smith were co-authors on the House file. That file exists before these amendments you brought in here today.
Yes, sir.
So I trust you will bring these amendments to the House. We can have further discussion over there as well.
Yes, sir.
Good.
So what staff will do is they'll engross this and get it out to members, and we'll put on the agenda next meeting. Okay?
Sounds good.
Okay, then what is left is the teacher restructuring, the Minneapolis issue, the pre-69s, the insurance pool, and any appropriations. That's what's left. Does the House want to give us an update of where things are?
Mr. Chair, on the appropriations, I believe the only appropriation we had was to fund the statewide firefighter study. That's
no, we had the Senate tax bill had a $17 million.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
So
okay, sorry.
Do you want to give us an update, or we're just plugging along? And was there an introduction of some sort? Representative?
15 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay, Representative Thiessen. And then we'll be done for the day. Representative Thiessen.
Go ahead.
Yes. A bill for the Minneapolis teachers' retirement, the bill to do a consolidation was entered on the House side today. And I have copies that I can
share
with senators.
And if anybody in the audience wants a copy, available at your office or? Will the House have it to give out, the House indexing?
I'm not sure what the day.
It will be in a day or two. Sure
2 days.
Day or two?
Yeah.
So if someone wants it today, you can go to Thiessen's office.
It also should be on.
Oh.
Generally, when bills are introduced, they do show up online under bill introductions. That's more immediate than hard copies.
Okay. And any other information in terms of who are the authors or anything? Well, that's a pretty good group.
And I don't know if you want to go into detail on that, but we can wait probably till.
I think we can wait.
But, I think we could have a discussion
Next meeting. Okay, next, we're going to meet next week sometime, and we should have everything else engrossed and ready to show people, I would think. And hopefully we may or may not have a determination about which package everything is in. And I think, isn't the general impression that the Minneapolis teacher and other major things would be in a separate package, not in the non-controversial bill?
I think so.
Right? So at least there's two bills here. There may be more. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, Mr. Chairman, at this day and time, I think that's a very fair statement.
Because I think what we'd like to do is the overall package that we've incorporated everything into, we want to get that introduced. I presume Smith will probably author it on the House side, the non-controversial big package.
I think so.
And either Bedsole or I are authored on the Senate side. And we would want that to be heard in GovOps like immediately March 2nd, 3rd, 4th. Immediately.
We have vehicle bills. We could just simply amend it onto an existing bill.
If we amend it onto a bill, we still have to have it heard in the GovOps committees. So what the idea would be, and the bulk of stuff, not including Minneapolis teachers and other stuff, these other items that are outstanding, will be handled expeditiously in the committees. I will talk to the chair of our GovOps committee and try to get that thing moved out first week, because that'd be nice to just get that out of here.
I agree.
So, Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, going back to item 8 on our agenda today.
Eight.
Yes.
Yes.
I've been thinking since we left that topic. And you've been talking about one bill or two bills,
right,
or we don't know how they're going to be packaged. I think that the testimony that was given today, although that there's still some opposition to having caps, but then the auditor talked about she wanted caps. I think the testimony that came out about the importance of passing a bill so that we can get it to, they can get it to the IRS for an opinion, is compelling enough to have it in the first bill
package
that you're talking about, because we have to get it on its way. Otherwise, further talk about whether there should be a cap or not is a kind of a waste of time, because we don't know how it's going to appear to the feds.
I think the only thought is that to pass the restructuring stuff, there may have to be some obvious reform items in that bill that brings a broader group of people to the table on the bill.
And we have till 2010 to get the IRS ruling.
Yeah.
I think what people are trying to do is package a reform bill that allows members to feel they, and governors, to feel they have a package that is balanced and gets some things done. That's the only one of the concerns there, or thoughts. So, okay? Thank you, members, for your patience. Meeting adjourned.
Very good.